Dunham. A quick reminder that the advice offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'll be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you've missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion. Put your news categories in the order you want. Pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at one, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will be talking about the price of housing and whether the government should intervene to make it more affordable. There is a war on motorists, say motoring organisations, as road lanes are about to be narrowed to prevent cars from overtaking cyclists. We'll hear from a transport journalist on that. Angela Rayner says she does not rule out running for the leadership of the Labour Party and says she hasn't gone away. But should she? We'll get a weather update as it's about to get much colder. Check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, a new policy on immigration will be announced tomorrow. We'll look at what it is and whether it will quiet the anger about that issue. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom... The Home Secretary is warning public support for migrants looking for sanctuary in the UK will fall apart without urgent reform. Shabana Mahmood's preparing to set out changes to MPs in the House of Commons tomorrow after studying the way Denmark approaches the issue. The former Conservative Immigration Minister, Kevin Foster, has been telling LBC the government should adopt the Danes' measures fully.
We'd looked at Denmark. They're obviously been quite successful. They've seen the number of asylum claims fall dramatically, whereas if you compare it to the UK, hitting record highs over the last year. So there's a lot to learn from Denmark, and I hope the government will take on board all of what it's done, not just looking at things that it might cherry pick from their programme.
And there'll be more on this with Nick Abbott here on LBC over the next half hour. A search for a missing sailor off the northwestern coast of Ireland has been called off after 2 days. The member of the Royal Fleet auxiliary ship Tide Search was last seen at about 10:30 on Friday night. Police Scotland say they're looking for a rapist after what's been called a horrendous attack on a woman in a park. She was assaulted at Brodie Park in Paisley early on Sunday morning. Angela Rayner's been criticising the government over its recent infighting, describing it as arrogant tittle-tattle. The former Deputy Prime Minister also denied reports claiming she may be planning a leadership challenge against Sir Keir Starmer. But LBC's political correspondent Aggie Chambray says Angela Rayner does seem to be ready for a comeback.
More cynical people might suggest that's because the government seems to be in a shaky place. Other people, I mean, people close to her have suggested to LBC that actually when Nigel Farage is around, she wants to be fighting. She wants to be taking the fight to him and will stay and remain in place as long as that is the case.
A safari park in Bedfordshire says it's managed to carry out high-risk surgery on a 500-kilo giraffe with a rare knee condition. The complex at Woburn says the animal's now recovering well following the procedure, which needed a team of specialist vets. And in sport, England have ended their World Cup qualifying campaign with a 2-0 win away to Albania. They're now at the top of Group K. LBC weather dry and cloudy for many areas overnight. Blustery showers along North Sea coast, which could be wintry. In the far north of the country and also over higher ground, we'll see a low of around 0 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. The Home Secretary is poised to set out what are called sweeping changes to the UK's asylum system on Monday, with those travelling to the UK illegally set to face a 20-year wait to gain settled status. These changes are aimed at making the UK less attractive for migrants and are modelled on the Danish system. Shabana Mahmood is expected to set out plans to deter migrants from coming to the UK and make it easier to deport those who do. She's understood to have based some of these changes on the approach in Denmark. Well, let's talk about this with Kevin Foster. Kevin is the former immigration minister under Boris Johnson. Joins us on the line now. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, good evening.
Could what is said to have made Denmark less attractive to migrants be applied with the same result here?
Well, certainly there's aspects of the Danish system that could well be brought into the UK and make a difference. For example, a temporary status rather than a permanent settlement for those who arrive illegally and then succeed in a claim, or you're unable to return them temporarily, restrictions on welfare payments, and also requiring that any family reunion is linked to being able to support those you're sponsoring to be in the UK. And also, of course, Denmark is signed up to very similar international law to what the UK is, and so it's a similar country to be comparing with, you know, a fair and democratic judicial system attached.
Yeah, different geography though, isn't it? Doesn't our proximity to France mean that we'll always be attractive, and it'll be difficult to prevent people from making that crossing?
Well, you could argue it's a lot easier to walk across a border than it is to swim across or to paddle across the channel in a dinghy. So there are challenges, and of course, you look at the fact that the Schengen border zone across most of Europe makes it relatively easy to get up towards Denmark, in the way, of course, we're not in Schengen either, and you come through there. So there are some good comparatives. Yes, of course, there will be some elements of difference, but certainly when we looked at it 4 or 5 years ago, and things like, for example, the Rwanda plan as well, it is a comparable country. And of course, as Labour, Trump probably may point out, that actually is also in the ECHR, and I suspect implementing some of these measures is probably going to be the last chance to try and deal with the small boat crisis, with Britain remaining part of the ECHR, or at the very least passing legislation that prevents a range of claims being lodged under it by those arriving from Belgium and France.
Well, I'm curious that if the government, when you were the minister, if they looked at the Danish system, why didn't you institute it then?
We legislated under the Nationalities and Borders Act 2022 for things like a differential track, which meant those arriving on small boat, and I must say lorry as well, because we realised that people, you know, if we just did it to those small boat, people may switch to lorries for example, temporary status. We obviously looked to bring forward the Rwanda plan. Those were certainly done under Boris Johnson. Some of those measures weren't taken forward under Mr. Sunak, who I didn't serve under, but certainly we did, and actually we legislated for some of them. Of course, opposed by Labour, but I'm interested now to see that they've recognised the logic of some of what was being proposed.
Isn't the English language something that is always going to provide a pull, as it's most people's second language?
Well, it's an element of that. But if we look at some of the countries that are the top four small boat arrivals, English is not commonly spoken. You know, we're not talking people arriving here, in many cases, from former Commonwealth countries, parts of former colonies, where English is very common. In many cases, we're talking of people arriving from places like Syria, Afghanistan, Eritrea, places where English is not one of the languages commonly spoken. And actually, many who arrive don't have a particularly good command of the English language. Those who do, who are more professional, may well actually look to apply for jobs and come via the actual legal migration system instead. But many are people who do not have good English language skills at all, as evidenced when we then try and interact with them after their arrival.
Yeah, these legal routes that you just mentioned, what do you make of the pledge to provide new safe routes to allow people fleeing war and so on to come and apply for asylum?
I suspect some of that is a bit of a cover for Labour MPs, who have probably spent a lot of time saying how awful some of these things would be if they were brought in when the Conservative Party proposed them, who are now going to end up voting for them as MPs sat in government. But we can look at routes we had, like the Ukraine scheme, which saw over 200,000 people given. Actually, it has to be said, that is not a route to permanent settlement either. You know, the idea was people come here whilst the war was on in Ukraine and then return. But the difference between safe and legal routes and the Channel boat arrivals, safe and legal routes are mostly women, children and families, whereas the vast majority of those arriving at Dover via small boats are single men aged between about 18 and 40, 45. So these are really different cohorts, and in reality, you can't offer absolutely everyone who wants to come to the UK, an opportunity to do so, you're going to have to prioritise. And few would say that single fit men between 18 and 40 is going to be top of the list for any spaces available under those types of routes.
It's a counterintuitive, though, isn't it? Because those single fit men of working age would be more beneficial economically to the country than the women with children that you mentioned earlier.
Well, it depends what your purpose of this is. And with youth unemployment rising, we're not particularly short of people without skills or detailed thing between 18 and 20 and 20 and 25. And after whatever legal migration system you want to have, if you can't enforce it and people can literally just buy their way around it by paying a people smuggler to transport them to the UK, then you've not really got an immigration system at all. And that's also where I think the government will face some challenges. They're announcing changes to what people have or their status when they arrive in the UK, but the big challenge is actually how you enforce this and remove people. And that's, I think, where they may find they will need to go further on things like the ECHR, the UN Refugee Convention and the Statelessness Convention, along with our own modern slavery laws.
Yeah, but the ECHR, as you've already said, is something that Denmark has signed up to, and they are being held up as an exemplar in this issue, so it really doesn't have anything to do with it. But
well, it does, certainly when you come to removals. Denmark certainly reduced the number of claims, but I think even in Denmark would point to the fact that there are issues. And of course, one of the things Labour will probably, and our government will look at, is how their courts interpret ECHR rights, because we have seen some absolutely bizarre judgments over the last year.
Migrants who enter the country without going through legal channels are to face a 20-year wait for settled status, even if they subsequently become upstanding members of the community. What do you make of that 20-year wait?
Well, we have had provision for long wait periods for those who arrived via irregular or not have status. For example, actually, if someone arrives under the Ukraine routes, it would be 10 years already before they could potentially get ILR. So it does make sense to have a penalty there. And in reality, if people want to come and be upstanding members of our society, then you don't start that period by breaking the law and coming into the country. And particularly, all these people leaving are leaving France and Belgium, which are patently safe, democratic countries, where if they had a claim for asylum, they could have made it there.
Yeah, but why should France take everybody and we take nobody? Just because of the fluke of geography?
I would certainly say, one, I don't think many people in the part of Calais would say they're particularly pleased with the outcomes for their community of this continuing trade and the criminality it brings to northern France. But similarly, we are not a country that doesn't step up to help. You know, as we've just touched on with the Ukrainian routes, we could talk about the Hong Kong route that we created as well, given the circumstance there and our unique link back to Hong Kong. But we simply cannot say that the solution for every problem around the world is to give people an opportunity to move to the United Kingdom. No one can suggest that.
But there's this 20-year wait, though. Won't that work against someone integrating? I mean, they might feel so vulnerable to deportation that they'll be discouraged from integrating.
Well, I think some of the evidence already is that integration is not going particularly well with people who've arrived and then received asylum. Much more likely to be unemployed some years after they've arrived than someone who's been in the UK. And what we're seeing, and I think Siobhan McRae is absolutely right to say it, this ongoing situation of tens of thousands of people coming across the channel each year is threatening integration in this country and undermining it, and that it does need to. And we just cannot tolerate a situation where, you know, people are brazenly ignoring our immigration rules, ignoring our law, and then coming here and literally gaming systems that were set up with good intent in the aftermath of World War II, but were never intended to be used as an opportunity to shop around Europe for where you'd like to claim asylum.
Yeah, I'm not sure you're right about the your inference that migrants are a sort of economic drain on the system, because on average they contribute more to the UK economy than the average native-born person.
I suspect you're conflating people who arrived here under actual legal migration routes along with placing them in.
Well,
regardless
of how they got here, they're still people.
Well,
migrants. Doesn't really matter, does it?
It makes quite a difference, actually, I think.
Well, it doesn't.
Really?
Not if we are...
Not if...
Yeah, okay, not not if we're talking about economics, which seems settled. I mean, you can argue about it all you like, but the
it's
OBR
not settled at all.
If the OBR figures state that it is, and I could quote them to you, but I've only got a brief 3-hour show and much less time talking to you. So let's move on. If somebody seeks asylum and it's granted, the plan suggests that they would be sent back to their home countries when it is considered safe. How would that work? Who would decide, and on what criteria?
Well, I suspect it would be done the same as we do now if we decide if a country's safe for someone to be returned to. You know, there's plenty of countries around the world that the Home Office assesses as being perfectly safe. In fact, countries that 20 or 30 years ago we might have considered for asylum. Croatia's a good example. Now an EU member, 30 years ago, we're still seeing the Balkan Wars, the wars in the former Yugoslavia. But today, no one would suggest that we should be offering asylum to a Croatian citizen. Now it's a member of the EU. So there are assessments done. This is something that's very standard. And of course, people regularly try and challenge this in the courts. And that's where I think the government will have to decide where it wants to set the bar. And this is where the ECHR comes in particular. For example, will they follow Germany's lead of returning, at this stage, convicted criminals to Afghanistan, but suggestions that we'll see wider returns being done actually by EU nations to Afghanistan, given their interpretation of who is at risk on return?
And this is all because the Home Office, it's actually all because they're being berated on a daily basis by the Tory party and Reform and the right-wing press. But the Home Office say that at the moment we are an international outlier. That's why they're bringing in these policies that were a supposed soft touch. But are we not about mid-table in Europe, for European countries, for foreign-born nationals per head, and about even with France and way below Germany in actual numbers?
Yeah, I think where you start looking at where the Home Office would probably point to would be statistics around things like the percentage of people using social housing in London who weren't born in the UK, and then probably break down that into those who have previously been granted refugee status and then accessed it. I wouldn't accept some of the rhetoric they're trying to make out that this is an amazingly generous package that's given. But as part of a wider strategy, you know, you need to, yes, disrupt, deal with gangs, detain, process people who arrive, and then look to remove. Part of that is removing the incentive, and particularly actually what many of them are looking for is to get to permanent settlement in the UK without going through the immigration system. And ultimately, the reason Labour is moving on this is not because of the press or the Conservative Party or even because of Reform. It's because they see in the communities they've represented for many years, people are absolutely fed up with this issue and are starting to vote for other parties. And therefore, they need to deal with this issue if they're to have any hope at the next general election.
It's not much of an issue, is it, though, really? It's in response to 40,000 or so people that arrive by boat a year. It's addressing that 0.05% increase in the population. It's just the grievance politics of all of the people that you just mentioned, Farage, the Tories and the right-wing press.
Well, there must be a lot of Conservatives in places that were formerly solidly Labour seats. They haven't voted Conservative before for that to be the case. And we've seen in the last couple of weeks that people who were quite happy living in a comfortable area to argue that they should be putting out the flags to welcome more small boats arrivals suddenly have a very different opinion when there's a couple of hundred about to turn up in their place they live. We've seen with the Green Party and Crowborough. But no, this is an issue fundamentally about are our borders sovereign? Can we enforce the law? And people seeing a fundamental unfairness, including many people who've migrated to this country themselves under our lawful migration system recently and in decades past, who just see people ignoring the law, coming here, and it's sort of getting a reward for doing so. That's what's driving this, that fundamental unfairness, and that's what people want to see tackled and are increasingly using their votes to say they want people in power who will do this.
Just finally, how would you rate your performance as former immigration minister under Boris Johnson, a period in which immigration skyrocketed in this country?
Well, certainly, those my first couple of years, it was lower than it was. But we did have planned in 2022. We've been drawn up under Boris to change some of the rules as we exited the pandemic period to increase some of the thresholds around salary, review some of the discounts for the shortage occupation list. Sadly, those were not taken forward following the change of leadership, but you'd obviously have to ask Mr. Sunak as to why that was the case.
If only you'd had more time. Thank you, Kevin. Kevin Foster, former Immigration Minister 2019 to 2022 under the premiership of Boris Johnson. So you perhaps have heard about this, the announcement for sweeping changes next week aimed at making the UK supposedly less attractive for migrants and modelled on that Danish system that we've heard so much about. What do you make of this? Is it going to fix what is described as the problem? Is it going to sate people's ire? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nick@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, then it's the same number as the phone. 0345 6060 973.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why is there delay?
Straight to the point.
This government is unravelling everywhere you look.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How can that make sense to anyone?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
So, look, saying thanks isn't my strong point, Dad. But it doesn't mean I don't want to say it. Like, telling you thanks for being, well, my dad. Saying thanks for keeping my chair at the dinner table. I only moved out 8 years ago. For teaching me how to load a dishwasher correctly. Didn't know there was a right way. And for all the advice I never listened to. But you know what I'm like. I never get round to saying it.
This Christmas, if you can't find the words, find the gift. John Lewis.
Have you ever felt like your investment advisor is giving you an off-the-shelf retirement plan? That they just want to put you in a box? But who wants that? At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a box. We create a plan that's just right for you because it's only right for us if it's right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So we're talking about the government's new policy on immigration, which will be announced tomorrow, but which we know much about. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, pledged to end what she called a golden ticket, which the government said had seen asylum claims surge in the UK, drawing people across Europe through safe countries and onto dangerous small boats. According to the Home Office, this overhaul of asylum policy, the largest in modern times, is going to mean that the UK is no longer an international outlier. It described Britain's current offer to asylum seekers as more generous than those of near neighbours on the European continent, where controls are apparently being bolstered. What do you make of all this? 0345 6060 973. Penzance. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I'd like to bust a couple of myths of the kind that your previous Pinocchio was presenting. And I'll start with the ECHR. So, since 1980, there have been a total of 29 cases taken by immigrants to defend themselves in the ECHR. And of that 29, the government's won 16 of those cases. That means in 45 years, 13 immigration cases have succeeded. Coming out of the ECHR will make no difference to this issue whatsoever, but it will make us a pariah on the world stage and give us some very big problems with our trade deal with the EU and our relationship with the US, who are custodians of the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, I think people are people with bad intent are piggybacking the ECHR onto this issue, and I'm with you. I don't believe it will make the slightest bit of difference on this issue, but it will make a big difference, perhaps, on the rest of our lives, because we will be relying on the kindness of whichever government happens to be in at the time.
Well, I'll come to that. But the next one is that British people are the gold medalists at going to other countries and not integrating, not learning the language, and imposing their culture, laws and religion. I mean, the reason that America and Australia are white Christian countries is because of uncontrolled immigration by nasty people who rode roughshod and committed genocide to the indigenous population.
Yes, and more recently, we tend to occupy
pockets of other countries as retirees or expats, and integration is the last thing that we do.
Well, on that subject, I've got hopefully quite an interesting one for you. So the largest contingent of British people outside of Britain reside in Spain, as I'm sure you know. And the Spanish government surveyed them and found that 60% of them don't speak a word of Spanish and only integrate with a Spaniard in a shop or a restaurant.
Yeah.
And the Spanish government didn't respond to that by whipping up hatred and marching down the streets and trying to burn their hotels down. They organised local events to promote integration, offered free language courses. And what I'd like to... I don't want to take up too much of your time, but what I'd like to finish with is a warning to those people listening who are considering voting to reform. Donald Trump, before he got elected, there was a bill going through Congress, a bipartisan bill that would have addressed the immigration problem at the borders. And as you know, I'm sure, he was campaigning to get elected, and he phoned his mates up to kill the bill because he knew it would take away his only shtick for getting elected. So he doesn't care about immigration at all. Him and Farage, they only care about how they can use it to wind people up. But the minute he got into power, he set about passing a bill that has organised the biggest transfer of wealth from poor people to rich people in living memory. So Farage will do exactly the same. He doesn't care about you reform voters. He just wants to get your vote on an issue, emotional issue like immigration, and then he'll go to work making you much poorer than you already are.
Well, that's an interesting take. Thanks for that, Andrew. 0345 6060 973. Nikki says, I live and work in Italy for part of the year, and an enclave of English immigrants here cause constant frustration. They don't learn Italian, they don't integrate or assimilate, spend most of their time drinking, and often behave aggressively. They also put pressure on local services without giving much back. The only respite is when some of them have to return to the UK because of the 90-day rule. If only we could apply Dane law to them. English immigrants, who'd have them, mate, says Nikki in Italy. 0345 6060 973. Tavistock. Hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. Yes, I pretty much agree with Andrew. And also what you said. I feel that the ECHR, which I believe was introduced by Churchill and others to protect countries from being taken over by a government that wishes to have total power over them. I think I'm right in saying to this. And I just can't help feeling that the way they go on about it, people like Farage and others, that's really what they're interested in doing. And the migrant thing is a way to get us to leave the ECHR.
Yeah, I find it highly suspicious that they're piggybacking that on the immigration issue when we're holding up Denmark as a positive example, and they have no intention of leaving the ECHR.
No, because it will hurt us. It won't hurt the migrants. It will, you know, it's just the door open to be for a populace to have no laws to protect them, because the government can simply override them, as Trump is doing all the time in America now.
Well, like I said, we would be relying on the kindness of strangers. Yeah. Whoever happens to be in power at the time would have complete control.
And as for, you know, the division between us, it's him and it's Nigel Farage and Suella Braverman before him who are doing this. It seems to me that it is an awful lot of hyperbole, and it's been relentless for so long that it's invaded everyone's brain. I mean, there was an intelligent-sounding man some weeks ago, not a Reform MP, I have to say, it definitely wasn't, but a person who said, the discussion was about internet harm to children and the suicide and the self-harm. And he rightly declared that this is a national crisis, but added second only to the small boats crisis. And I thought, you know, our perspective has become beyond wicked. And it's become a national mantra, illegal migration. And I tell you what I think it's got a lot to do with. That old quote from a famous journalist: the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace in a constant state of alarm. This is what I was going to say first, actually, that you say about sating people's ire. this won't sate people's ire because it is going to be continually roused, and to finish this quote, in a constant state of alarm, and hence clamorous to be led to safety, presumably by Farage or whoever, by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. And I just see that going on all the time.
Yes, you know? I don't think it's in the interests of some people who are using this to further their interests. It's not in their interests for the boats to stop.
No.
And even if they did, I suspect that it wouldn't make any difference, because it's not the fear of of something that's real, it's the fear of the unknown.
Yes, the hobgoblins, the imaginary hobgoblins, in fact.
Good to talk to you, Rose. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. More of your calls on this to come. And Angela Rayner has hit out at Labour infighting as what she called arrogant tittle-tattle. We'll talk about that. Take more of your calls on 0345 6060 973. But first at 10:30, it's the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Home Secretary is warning public support for migrants looking for sanctuary in the UK will fall apart without urgent reform. Shabana Mahmood is preparing to set out changes to MPs in the House of Commons tomorrow. The British aircraft carrier HMS Prince of Wales has been placed under the command of NATO. The Defence Secretary says the move is an example of the UK's NATO First plan, which was set out in the Strategic Defence Review. And Police Scotland say they're looking for a rapist after what's being called a horrendous attack on a woman in a park. She was assaulted at Brodie Park in Paisley early on Sunday morning. LBC weather, dry and cloudy for many areas overnight with blustery showers along North Sea coasts. They could be wintry in the far north of the UK and across high ground. We'll see a low of 0 degrees.
This is LBC.
Calling all black cab drivers. Let's talk about those quieter times when your meter's taking a little nap. Why not consider Uber? We can give your meter a wake-up call. Join close to 1,000 black cab drivers already on Uber and gain access to millions of passengers at the touch of a button. Black cabs on Uber are priced by your meter, and the service fee will be no more than 5% until the end of 2025. Turn downtime into prime time. Go to uber.com/blackcabs to start earning today. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things like the upcoming changes to renting are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well? You're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
What are your calls on the subject of the new immigration rules that are set to be announced tomorrow, but about which we know quite a lot already? And you can call 0345 6060 973. But let's talk about Angela Rayner for a moment and the travails of the Labour Party. Angela Rayner has condemned what she called arrogant tittle-tattle and Labour infighting dominating the past week in her first major interview since her resignation. The former Deputy Prime Minister is often considered a potential successor to Keir Starmer and declined to rule out running for the job or returning to frontline politics. Let's talk about this with Luke Francis. Luke is Associate Partner at Pagefield, a PR consultancy agency, and former Chief of Staff and Political Advisor to Lisa Nandy. Hello, Luke.
Hi, Nick. Good to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us. Angela Rayner says she has not gone away. Should she?
No, I don't think so. I think she is a very effective communicator. She's got great name recognition in the country. She is hugely respected across the Labour Party and the wider movement. And I think she probably still has a really big role to play for the Labour Party over the next few years. And I think, you know, you'd have to be an idiot to bet against her returning in some form.
She will be dragging a lot of baggage around with her, though, won't she?
Yes, I think it's still, you know, fairly fresh in people's memories, the nature and manner of her departure from government. And so I do think it is too soon for her to be thinking about a return to frontline politics. But we've got some really dangerous moments coming up for this leadership and this government over the next few months. Obviously, the budget in 10 days' time is going to be a really, really difficult moment. And then we've got elections next May in Scotland and Wales and local elections as well. And if they are as bad as the polls suggest they're going to be, you can see a world in which in 6 months' time, the public memory of Angela Rayner's departure has started to disappear. And you've got a leadership that are coming off the back of some really poor election results. And I think at that point, you know, you could really see the risk of a potential leadership challenge and someone like Angela Rayner being the rallying point for lots of disillusioned and disaffected backbench Labour MPs.
Do you think this government has been treated fairly by the public? I mean, the public have been fed a constant diet of propaganda that the government is a shower from the moment that they won the election, which was entirely predictable. I mean, they've have achieved much in that time. They've invested in infrastructure, they've rolled out breakfast clubs in schools, they've invested in renewable energy, they've started a national wealth fund, they've increased NHS appointments, and so on and so on and so on. And yet nobody knows anything about these things. All we know is the infighting and a couple of issues which the press have harped on about almost constantly, the winter fuel allowance and will they, won't they raise the two-child benefit cap. So are they being treated unfairly by the public? Have they achieved things that would be celebrated by any other government? Or are they actually adrift?
Well, I don't think it will come as a surprise to anyone that we have quite a hostile press in this country, and particularly the right-wing press, who will inevitably want to focus on some of those damaging problems that are impacting the government. But the government, in reality, need to be doing more of what you've just done, which is getting out there on the front foot and listing some of those achievements. And I think all too often we find ourselves being dragged into these negative arguments, the infighting, the navel-gazing, fighting far too often on the territory that people like Nigel Farage and Reform UK are comfortable fighting in, and far less time banging on about what we've already achieved. And actually, we've done the pitch rolling. We've talked about the inheritance from successive failing Tory governments, but we haven't done the positive bit yet, which is talking about our successes and then setting out the vision for what we want this country to be. That's the bit for me that's really missing, which is we know there are going to be difficult times ahead. There are going to be difficult decisions that need to be taken, not least at this budget in a week and a half's time. But people need to buy into that long-term vision for what this country can and the country that this Labour government wants to build. And that's what we're missing at the moment, is that positive vision piece where people can say, actually, I understand why you want to put a penny or two on income tax, because that's going to deliver the public services that we want, or it's going to deliver the homes that we need to build. That's the bit that's missing for me. And that's the bit that, in the absence of that positive vision, it gives that right-wing press the opportunity to attack and to focus on the negatives. And it becomes much, much harder to push back if you aren't telling that positive story.
Yes, previous Labour governments have managed to tell that positive story because they've had, call them what you like, press attack dogs or very efficient operators who will push that message. Why have they been? I mean, you work in a PR consultancy, so you're the perfect chap to ask. Why have they been so particularly inept at putting out a good message?
So I think one of the biggest challenges that this government's had from day one is the lack of institutional experience of what it's like to be in government. And we had some fantastic people in opposition who did a fantastic job of getting the Labour Party into a good place. But the realities of government are completely different. They come at you very, very quickly. It's very easy to lose control of the news cycle and lose control of the narrative. And actually, if I was being really critical, and I say this as someone who spent the better part of 15 years working desperately to get a Labour government in place, is that we haven't had that story to tell, even from day one. You know, from the outset, this Labour government was talking about the inheritance, the 20 billion black hole, and it set quite a gloomy mood over the first few days and weeks and months of this government. At no point have we done the positive hope piece that I think the country was so desperate for, and it was why Labour won that overwhelming majority. It was a mandate for change. It was a mandate for doing something differently and building a better country. And I think that has been the challenge, is the realities of government come so quickly, they hit you so hard that it's very difficult if you don't have that clear vision from day one and that clear story that you want to tell, and then the policies and the decisions that roll out of that, it becomes really, really hard to get back on the front foot. And I think we've seen a real churn in terms of senior figures and staff around the government. So there's been no consistency, and there is no one at the heart of government who is pushing that narrative and that story through everything they say and do. And you know, the reality is that has to come from the top. That has to come from the Prime Minister and his team. They are the only people who can set the course for this government and ensure that everything they're saying and doing is helping them get there.
Is the Labour Party, the sort of the public persona of the Labour Party, merely a function of Keir Starmer, who doesn't come across as a sort of just William ruffled, oh, I'm doing my best Boris Johnson type of character, which people sort of warm to naturally? Mm. He's more of a sort of a dour, kind of grey, depressive functionary, which might be good for the running of the country, you know, a bit of boring after the chaos of the Tory years would be welcome, but he doesn't really inspire.
And I think the big challenge is there are communicators in public life now who are very, very good at that, who pass the pub test. People like Nigel Farage, who are very, very good at boiling down complicated, nuanced problems into small sound bites and simple solutions that we know in reality won't work, but actually they, in the 15, 20 seconds that people engage with politics that day, they make sense to people. They talk about the issues that people care about, and they land and resonate with voters. And I think Keir has struggled with that. I don't think he is a natural communicator. I don't think he is someone who exudes warmth and who is a comfortable actor on the national stage in that way. It was never his pitch. He was always promising competence, stability, accountability in his leadership. And he was never someone who promised the bombast of Boris Johnson or, you know, the populism of Nigel Farage. The problem with that comes when people perceive a lack of competence or a lack of accountability and transparency. That's when it becomes very difficult, and it opens up the door to people like Nigel Farage, who offer simplified solutions to very complex problems. And I do think that Labour, talking about Angela Rayner, but there are communicators across the Labour Party, Myle Boss, Lisa Nandy, there are people who are very, very good at getting out and speaking the language of the public and talking about the issues that matter to people. And actually, it's a team effort, getting those people front and centre, getting them out, challenging some of the, you know, the policies that Nigel Farage is putting out there that we know would be damaging to this country, and we know are non-British in so many ways. It makes us insular, it makes us small on the global stage. That isn't the country we are. But Labour need to get on the front foot and get out there making the argument for the country that we want to be. And that needs to be coming from Keir Starmer, but it needs to be coming from around the cabinet table and every part of the Labour Party in Parliament, because that's the only way that they can start to close that gap in the polls and actually start to build the country that we all desperately want to see.
Yeah, and yet, even though we have just been sort of talking him down, and the press do it constantly, despite all the attacks of the right-wing press, when asked to choose who would be the best Prime Minister, Keir Starmer beat Nigel Farage, he beat Kemi Badenoch, he's tied with Ed Davey, which is something of a surprise, and Ed Davey would beat Nigel Farage and Kemi Badenoch. So do you think perhaps his faults have been somewhat overstated?
Well, and that is a cause of huge optimism for me, that even with Labour doing very poorly in the polls, even with the almost sort of daily negative headlines that are out there, that when the country look at Keir Starmer and Nigel Farage, they still front for Keir Starmer as the person they want to lead and be the face of this country. And that, for me, is a cause of huge optimism. And, you know, that is something that the Labour Party can build on, that actually there is a coalition in this country of people who believe that this country is better and stronger when it is diverse, it's outward-looking, that it focuses on the things that bring us together rather than things that divide us. And that needs to be the focus for the Labour Party now, is looking at that and thinking there is a majority in this country who reject the politics of Reform UK and Nigel Farage. They reject that idea of division. That's what we need to cling on to now. But we need to give those people the vision. We need to give those people the policies that they can get behind. Because the Labour Party don't just need to look to the right. There is a real threat on the left from a resurgent Green Party. As you say, Ed Davey polling very well. Perhaps Keir Starmer needs to go down a few more roller coasters and fall into a few more lakes, and that might give him some clear blue water. But in the absence of that, he needs to set out that vision. And that is, we've seen at times Keir Starmer can be passionate about this. When he's talking about the things that really matter to him, he cares about the NHS because it's personal to him. And that's the bit that resonates with voters. And that's the bit that people can look at and say, OK, I might not like everything this man's doing, but I trust that he's got the best interests of this country at heart. I trust that he wants me and my family to have a better future. And that's something I can vote for and get behind. And that's how Labour beat Reform. That's how they win the next election. And that's how they can start to deliver some of those promises that they set out in the election last year.
Good to talk to you, Luke. Thanks for that. Luke Francis, Associate Partner at Pagefield, a PR consultancy agency and former Chief of Staff and Political Advisor to Lisa Nandy. Now we're going to take a short break, then we're going to come back to your thoughts about this this supposed Danish system, which is going to be announced tomorrow by the Home Secretary. Sweeping changes aimed at making the UK less attractive for migrants.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
If at first you don't succeed...
A migrant who is sent to France under the one-in, one-out scheme has returned to the UK on a small boat.
Try...
It is still at the pilot phase, but that has huge potential.
Try...
This pilot with France is a milestone.
And try again.
What we see at the moment is abuse of the legal system. They're using it against us. That's unacceptable.
The government reached for the Danish model in a major migration shake-up.
Denmark's new migration policies have driven down successful asylum claims to a 40-year low. Can Labour start to make gains with the help of the Danes? I'm LBC's Henry Riley, reporting from Copenhagen.
Join me, Nick Ferrari, tomorrow morning to discover what makes this such a great Dane project.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new. Tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we're talking about tomorrow, the Home Secretary poised to set out sweeping changes to the UK's asylum system based on those that are apparently working in Denmark. What is your opinion on what you've heard about that? Derby. Hello, Brent.
Hello, my friend. It's a dead cat. It's another dead cat moment. Denmark's the latest
They just don't know what they're doing. The thing about illegal immigration has become a bit of a Brexit thing, where they just keep harking on about it and harking on about it because they want to distract us. And the European Court of Human Rights is the latest Brexit as well, where they just keep harking on about it as well. Look, migration is a natural phenomenon. We have a lot of unmanaged migration, that's true, but that's the same as the world over. That's always been the case. The thing that they have to get the head around is the migration out. There's a record number of people leaving the country, which is fueling a record number of people coming in. So why are people leaving the country? Well, because they're making policies like this. And the other thing is European Court of Human Rights is undermining the Goose Valley Agreement. And I'd just like for once somebody on this side of the Irish Sea to have some understanding of the complexity of the peace process before they start messing around with things again. Because it's really heartbreaking when they just dismiss it and go, just like Brexit all over again. The European Court of Human Rights underpins the Good Friday Agreement because people across that side of the water just don't trust the British government. And every right to not trust. My parents took to the streets in the 60s to campaign for civil rights. When a government starts taking away people's rights, which are hard fought and hard won, you've got to have alarm bells ringing. You really do, especially when they're attacking a neutral court which held our government to account. And this is what it's really about. They just don't want to be held to account. They don't like us little minions. I mean, what's next? The Magna Carta is going to come under attack. The Bill of Human Rights, the 1685 Bill of Human Rights, what's next? Are we going to reverse the English Civil War and put monarchy back in charge? I just don't understand where it's going to end, because quite simply all they want to do is just take our rights away from us and find an excuse, blame the foreigner, basically. That's all it's really about.
Well, it's very Trump-like. I mean, Donald Trump does not like any questioning of his authority, and I suspect that those who want to take us out of the ECHR have visions of them being in that number 10, and they don't want their authority questioned either.
Yeah, well, the European Court of Human Rights is just there to hold our government to account as an institution. It's not political. It's just doing its job, and its job is checks and balances. And we need checks and balances, especially when you take artificial intelligence, especially when you take corporates. You take the corporate oversight in this world at the moment, where we're losing our rights, our actual physical rights when it comes to our own identity. We've got our physical rights when it comes to our economic rights. So you start to ask the question, why do they keep attacking these institutions? Same as the BBC. BBC is an impartial broadcaster who asks questions. Is this really part of an authoritarian agenda? I don't know. But what you have to ask yourself, why do they keep attacking the European Union, which held our government to account? Now the European Court of Human Rights, which holds our government to account. What will it be, judges next? What will it be, independent bodies next? Because they just seem to want to attack anybody who dares to question what's going on. And we've heard of the European Court of Human Rights the last 30 or 40 years. Why all of a sudden has it become an issue?
They seem to be cloaking themselves in the flag and at the same time attacking all the institutions that the public hold most dear. Brent, I'm going to have to leave it there, but thanks for that. Hackney, hello, Richard.
Hello, Nick. I want to get back to immigration and the small boat crisis, in inverted commas. And it's like you say that it's 5% of the people who come over here on small boats. And I'm sorry to get bogged down in numbers, but of that 5%, most of them, as in over 80%, come from just five countries. So if we wanted to stop the small boat crisis, all we need to do is provide safe routes from five different countries, not hundreds. We don't have to extend the hand of friendship all over the world. But if we opened slots in five countries, that would basically eliminate the small boats. I mean, there's always going to be someone who chances it. I mean, for example, I don't know if you know this, but of the people who come over here, 2% of the people on small boats are from India. Now, we have the most open border in the world with India, and yet 2% of people still turn up here on small boats. So there's always going to be someone. But if we put safe haven, safe passages in Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Eritrea, that would be most of the problem taken care of.
I doubt that, though. Even if we eliminated all people coming here by whatever method, I don't think that it would actually address the issue for people who affect to be so very angry about this. It's not how they get here. It's that they are here.
Yes, I heard that, and it was interesting to listen to Kevin Foster, who I think is the man behind the Boris wave.
I'm sure he wouldn't be. He wouldn't take kindly to being reminded of that. But yes,
yes, and he was there telling us how generous we were as a nation. Because we offered places to Ukrainians, and we offered places to people from Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Well, people from Hong Kong, that was 1999. That was 25 years ago. That was when China retook Hong Kong.
I think we're about as generous as most other similar countries, but we seem to have painted ourselves into being something that we actually aren't. Other countries in Europe take more immigrants than we do. We're about mid-table, about the same as Denmark and France per head of population. But Slovenia, Portugal, the Netherlands, Spain, Norway, Cyprus, Belgium, Germany, Sweden, Iceland, Austria, Ireland, Malta, Switzerland, Luxembourg and Liechtenstein all take more per head of population than we do. So we're not that generous.
Let me just throw out a wild idea. Let's just take the three big problem countries. I mean, Albania used to be a problem country, a problem in inverted commas. We were getting a lot of Albanian refugees, but then their country stabilized and they now look like they're going to join the EU, and we're experiencing negative migration now. Albanians are leaving. So in one sense, the Tory government has succeeded in making the country so bad that people would rather go and live in Albania.
No offence to Albanians. No, Richard, time's running out for me on this hour, so I'm going to have to move along, but thanks for that. Manchester, hello, Mike.
Hi, Nick. Nice to speak to you.
Mike.
My worry with all this, I'm coming at this from a different point of view from most of your callers. My worry with this is that I do see this issue as so polarising that it's really starting to damage the stability of the country. And especially with social media, there's different angles coming at this, and there's different viewpoints coming in that weren't there before. Mm. And for me, what she's trying to do, I welcome it. It's not enough. I personally think, and I think she might even struggle to get it past the Labour Party anyway.
But what would be enough? I suspect that nothing would be enough for the people that are making most noise about this. If all immigration stopped today, we had zero people coming in, there would still be people who have come in who aren't the same colour as the people on the demonstrations. And so then their anger would be just directed away from the boats that aren't arriving anymore to people who have a different shade of skin than they do.
Well, possibly. I mean, people, I think there is going to be an anger there now. But what I'd say to that is, where was the mandate? Where was the consent from the people ever for the scale of immigration we've seen into this country? Because no one's gone to the ballot box. The Conservatives have never stood, on a manifesto where they've said, we're going to lower immigration, and then when they get in, they're going to give us mass immigration on steroids, which is what they've done. That, no one's ever voted for that.
Well, no, but you vote for nobody would ever say that.
But of course, you
just vote for a government based on the direction of travel you think they're going in, and the specifics of it. Then you leave to them, and then give them your judgment in 5 years. Thanks, Mike. Got to move on. Glasgow. Hello, Eric.
Well, right, the 20 years for these people, apparently, yeah.
That is one of the proposals, yes.
Right, so 20 years. What's going to happen to these people? What are these people going to do in the 20 years that are here?
Well,
who's going to employ these people, knowing that if something happens, they'll have to go home. There's no... That's a career, Nick.
It does seem like detrimental to them integrating fully if they have to wait 20 years to gain settled status. That's practically half a lifetime of work.
And the people, are the benefits changing? Where are they going to stay? What sort of conditions are going to be imposed on them? All this sort of stuff is all up in the air. 20 years is a prison sentence for murder. Another thing, just a little bit, a different side of the coin. Why don't some of these young men do some military service, 5 or 6 years, then be granted residency, show a bit of allegiance to the country? Australia, I'm thinking about it, because this country's falling apart. I'm an ex-British Army soldier. You need to do 90 days in Australia at the Australian Defence, Force, 90 days, and you get a Australian citizenship.
I don't know whether that's one of the policies. It's an interesting thought. Thanks for that, Eric. Plenty of opportunities to talk about this on LBC in the near future, because that policy is going to be announced tomorrow. We're going to change it in the next hour. Roads across the UK could be made narrower in an attempt to make them safer for cyclists. Official guidance from the government says that narrower roads, or lanes specifically, would make it clearer to motorists that there is not enough space to safely overtake cyclists. Motoring campaigners have called this a war on motorists, saying it's going to worsen traffic jams and promote conflict between drivers and cyclists. What do you think? Narrower lanes to make them safer for cyclists because car drivers would feel disinclined to overtake them. Is that a good idea? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. The Home Secretary says new asylum measures are not racist and will tackle the broken system. Shabana Mahmood's proposals would only allow refugees to stay in the UK temporarily, while also meaning it would take longer to secure settled status. But the chief political commentator at The Independent, John Rentel, has been telling LBC some more questionable ideas may also be raised by her.
There's a particularly odd suggestion in there that people who are granted refugee status could still be sent away from this country if they break the law or if they don't get work, which sounds to me as if it's contrary to all sorts of international law.
A man's been arrested on the suspicion of murder after a 21-year-old woman was found dead at a boatyard in West Wales. The body of Corinna Baker was found on Saturday at Cardigan in Ceredigion. The British aircraft carrier HMS Prince of Wales has been placed under the command of NATO. The Defence Secretary John Healey says the move is an example of the UK's NATO First plan that was set out in the Strategic Defence Review. An MP is demanding to know how suspected fly-tipping gangs have been able to dump what's described as a mountain of rubbish in Oxfordshire. The 10-metre-high lump of waste stretches along a field between the River Cherwell and the A34 near Kidlington. The Liberal Democrat's Callum Miller believes it will cost tens of millions of pounds to remove. Laura Reinecker is from the environmental charity Friends of the Thames.
It's of epic proportions. This pre-shredded waste, which has obviously been highly well organised, is now leaching into the river and into the earth around the river, and is a massive ecological disaster.
The head of NHS England says fewer hospital doctors have decided to strike during the latest five-day walkout. Sir James Mackey says there are early indications this week's numbers are down as the dispute over pay and conditions continues. And some of the US National Guard troops who've been sent to Chicago and Portland are being withdrawn by the Pentagon. They've been deployed by President Donald Trump. He'd been claiming they were needed to reduce crime and help immigration enforcement. LBC weather, dry and cloudy for many areas overnight. Blustery showers along North Sea coast, which could be wintry in the far north of the UK. And over high ground as well, we'll see a low in some areas of around 0 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Road lanes across the country are to become narrower to stop cars overtaking cyclists as part of what the right-wing press are calling a new war on motorists. Official guidance published last week on the government's website says that the standard width of a road lane in Britain, which is about 12 foot now, is no longer appropriate because of the safety risk posed to cyclists. Instead, lanes on local roads should either be shrunk no more to no more than 10 foot 8 or expanded to at least 12 foot 10. And it's thought that space constraints in towns and cities means that they are far more likely to shrink than expand. Let's talk about this with the transport journalist and author of Roads Were Not Built for Cars, Carlton Reed, who joins us on the line now. Hello, Carlton.
Hello there.
What do you make of this plan?
Not terribly controversial, and certainly not how certain parts of the media have been portraying it. I mean, it kind of went slightly viral in those right-wing media in over the weekend, but it's been published last week and to no great acclaim. What you've got to bear in mind that this is not like one single measure. Active Travel England, which is a government body, was bringing lots of measures in, including, you know, wider space for pedestrians, less trip hazards for pedestrians. So there are lots of measures. So it's rather strange that only one of these many measures was picked out.
Yes, well, it does fit into the press's narrative that motorists are being picked on. Do you think that reducing the width of a road will actually affect the way that people drive? Won't they simply get more irate with cyclists ahead of them if they can't overtake them?
Well, all of these, either road widening or road narrowing, has been taking place, you know, on our roads for an awfully long time. So nothing that Active Travel England are suggesting are something that motorists are not used to. You know, these things happen. You know, Fleet Street can be made into this kind of slightly narrower. There's an enormous amount of streets already out there that are this width. So this is not something that's going to be alien to motorists at all. Will it make some motorists go slower behind cyclists? Potentially. Certainly, you know, even though it's just paint, you know, there's nothing to stop, you know, people doing other things on these roads. You know, there are not generally going to be barriers here. It's literally just paint. But paint is guidance. And the sensible motorists will think, well, there's a reason why the road is this width, the lane, sorry, not the road, sorry, I should say lane. And you correctly said lane at the beginning. So this is not roads being made either less wide or wider. It's lanes. It's the travel lanes that are being either shrunk or, as you also mentioned, made wider. I don't think those things are going to make a huge amount of difference because they're already out there now anyway. And this is not as though every single road in the whole of the UK is going to be changed overnight. It's going to be the odd road here and there when there's already going to be a little bit of road markings change. So it really isn't incredibly radical.
But just on a practical level, does it make sense to narrow our road lanes as our cars get ever bigger?
There's an argument to say not, because SUVs, you know, are getting fatter and fatter and fatter. But there's also an argument for saying, well, maybe we should be actually making car parking spaces smaller and roads and lanes narrower in order to get through to the message that we shouldn't be having those wider and wider, wider cars, which are fulfilling no huge benefit out there and making everybody's life a misery because you get two SUVs on a very wide road, and it becomes a bit of a push to get through. So many cities, Cardiff is the one that was the one a couple of weeks ago, are now bringing in measures to encourage people through means of making them pay, of not bringing their SUVs into city centres. So I think many more cities, as we go forward, will be doing that because as cars get wider and wider, you know, even the Mini today, you know, is a good 2 foot wider than the Mini of the 1960s. Well, something's got to be done, basically. Otherwise, we're just not going to get around and the congestion will get worse because of wider and wider cars.
Yeah, when you see one of the old Minis on the road, you do double take, don't you? It looks impossible for a human being to get in it. But I can recall we used to have competitions as to how many people you could squeeze into an old Mini. Mm. It seems hard to believe, really. And, of course, this kind of thing is in effect in places like France and Italy, where if you go into one of those medieval cities, you are confronted with roads that are so tiny that you couldn't possibly get around in one of those SUVs. So those cities are populated with tiny little cars, maybe not the size of an old Mini, but certainly not the giant bloated machines that we drive around in this country.
Yes, and in an Italian hill town, you certainly couldn't get an SUV through those streets. You know, they were built for standard carriages, which were 7.5 foot wide. And that's why our road widths, you know, historically have been at 12 foot wide. So roughly just under double the width. So if you make vehicles get wider and wider and wider, they're not going to fit anymore.
And the thinking behind this is that narrower lanes will make it clear to motorists that they can't overtake cyclists. Does that give too much credit to the average driver's sense of consideration for others?
An awful lot can be done with design. So you can modify people's behaviour just by making the street look different. So this is what it's talking about here, is making the street look different. And one of the other stipulations in the... It's a 16-point document with lots of different measures in there. But one of the things is to remove, you know, these pedestrian islands, which are often plonked in the middle of the two carriageways, ostensibly to make it safer for pedestrians, but it makes pinch points, which makes it actually more dangerous for everybody. So as well as these road width or the lane width measures, they're talking about removing, or in future removing, so any new project, removing those pinch points. So all of these things, they're not being done to annoy people. They're being done to save lives and to just make it more pleasant in cities for everybody. So roads, as my car suggests, my book suggests, you know, roads were not built for cars. Roads, you know, have thousands and thousands of years of history long before motor cars came along. Roads are there for everybody, not for one class of road user. So these measures are perfectly sensible. And probably most people will not notice. They're going to be tiny differences in either the going wider or narrower, and it'll almost be imperceptible, but it'll be enough to give people the suggestion that they should either stay behind another road user that is slower in front, that doesn't necessarily have to be a cyclist, or when the roads are going to be made wider, because that's the other part of the equation that the right-wing media haven't really touched upon, that, you know, some lanes will be made wider, there'll actually be that more room for motorists to pass. So there's always that, you know, there's two parts of this equation, and it's strange that only one part is being discussed.
Well, it's part of this narrative that there is a war on motorists, which seems odd given how much of our shared space is given over to traffic. And I think you're right. For the benefit of everyone, the health of the nation, the exercise involved, the reduced congestion, the cleaner air, the more pleasant surroundings, the reduced noise, shouldn't we actually be doing everything we can to prioritise bikes over cars?
We should be coming up with measures that make it more sensible for people in whatever mode of transport you are using. So that can be a bicycle, that can be a scooter, that's a wheelchair user, it can be a pedestrian, and it can be a person in a car. It's just whatever, or underground if you're in London, it's whatever method of transport you choose should be made safer, made more pleasant. So if you have a narrower traffic lane, and if that reduces speed of motor cars, that's actually good for everybody, including the motorists, because you will probably actually get through cities more quickly. And it sounds crazy, but if you don't go speeding up to the next traffic light and you just go through at an average pace, you actually go through probably quicker than if you're doing this staccato speed thing of going through the city, which causes a danger for everybody. You really don't get through the city any more quickly. So if through design you can actually encourage better behaviour, that will actually lead to not just more safety, but just better conditions for everybody in whatever form of transport they have chosen.
Yes, I mean, it's blindingly obvious, but it's something that the press seem to avoid stating, and that's that as soon as you get out of your car, you're a pedestrian.
Absolutely. So today I've been in a car, I've been on the pavement as somebody walking. I haven't actually been on a bicycle today, but other days I will be on a bicycle too. So these labels that, you know, somebody is a motorist, somebody is a cyclist, and somebody, you know, is a radical pedestrian, none of these things are genuinely the case. You know, people are multimodal, and there's no reason for the press to worry here, really, because none of these proposals are incredibly radical. They're all out there already. There's streets designed like this already. There's nothing, ministry is coming along to radically make every single road in Great Britain narrower.
No, but there are some roads that are getting narrower, and much narrower than they used to be, certainly around where I go in London. But does that actually make sense? If that's what they're doing, if they're doing that in order to slow down cars so that they feel that they can't overtake cycles, wouldn't it be better to keep the roads at the same width and then carve off a mini lane for cycles so that they don't occupy the same space as cars?
That's kind of a different argument in that, yes, when you have separated infrastructure for cyclists, that's actually they're the roads that aren't being discussed in these documents, because Active Travel England kind of aren't in this particular document aren't really discussing separation. These are the roads that that are shared by all forms of traffic, motorised traffic and non-motorised traffic. So the separated infrastructure isn't really part of any of these proposals.
And just finally, car drivers might think that they're being put upon because they pay road tax, MOTs, fuel tax, congestion charge and so on. Cyclists, on the other hand, pay nothing, none of the above. Can you understand why some car drivers might feel that they're...
Not really, because that's not how roads are paid for. Roads are paid for out of general taxation.
Well, yes, technically.
They're not paid for. They're not paid for by motorists. I'm a motorist, I don't pay for roads. I pay for roads and all other things in this country out of the general taxation.
Yes, technically, yes. But however...
Not just technically, but absolutely. That's how roads, hospitals, the military, that's how everything is paid for. Nothing is hypothecated. Nothing is paid for by one type of taxation.
Yes,
everything goes into the general pot.
Quite. I know it's not ring-fenced, but car drivers do end up paying a lot more tax than an average cyclist does. So do you understand why some drivers might feel that they're being put upon?
No, because I'm a cyclist, I'm a motorist, I'm a pedestrian, I'm all these things at the same time. So how am I, as a cyclist, not paying this supposed taxation when I'm a motorist too? So I am paying that, if that is the argument, I am paying that taxation. So it's moot. You know, taxes are raised generally, and motorists, if you actually... And as a motorist ourselves, I will admit to this, we actually pay nowhere near as much as we should, because there's something called negative externalities. So all of the different things like pollution, all of the different road crashes, deaths, all of the things, noise pollution, all of these things cost far in excess of what motorists put in. via motoring taxation. So if anything, motoring taxation should be tripled, maybe. So before people complain about we're being paying too much, it's like, no, you're paying way too little for the societal costs you are actually putting on everybody. And I'm including myself there because I am a motorist too.
Very good to talk to you, Carlton. Thanks so much for that. Carlton Reed, transport journalist, author of Roads Were Not Built for Cars. So what do you make of that? There was a slightly controversial suggestion at the end there that motorists pay triple what they're paying at the moment in associated taxes. We could talk about that. But what about this proposal to decrease the width of road lanes in order to make it less likely that a car will overtake cyclists? You'll just have to sit behind them because there won't be enough room to get by. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
This is LBC.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Step aboard the legend of the Titanic, London's award-winning exhibition devoted to the world's most famous ocean liner at Dock X Canada Water. Walk her decks, explore her cabins, discover her secrets. With 360-degree projections, VR, an interactive metaverse, artifacts and more. Book your tickets today at legendoftitanic.com.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We're talking about traffic calming measures. I suppose this is what this is. It's the idea to reduce the width of road lanes so that cars will be disencouraged from overtaking cyclists. And you'll just have to sit in traffic behind them because there won't be enough space to get by. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. Bridge End. Hello, Bo.
Oh, Nick, I was having a cold one. I wasn't going to get involved tonight. But men in Lycra rule the world now. Men in Lycra rule the world, do they?
Well, Wales.
No, this is a serious point. Yeah, well, I'm down in Wales.
Let me ask you this: Wales was in the forefront of not blanket rules about 20-mile-an-hour zones, but certainly widespread. How's it working out?
Awful, awful. It's slowly, because it's not about cars, Nick. It's about the very veins and infrastructure of our country. Delivery drivers. Our economy's on its backside. Do you agree with that? We need to get this country moving. And I tell you what, the Welsh government now, okay, are bringing in now 4x4s, not into the cities. But I watch a few 4x4s. It's mum, dad, granny, three children going in, spending money in our cities. It's you know, build velodromes. If you want to drive round on a cycle, build velodromes and get them off our roads. Let's get this country moving, for God's sake, man.
But wouldn't it be better for the health of the nation if we got the country moving on a bicycle?
Yes, but in velodromes, not on the, I'm not pro car or pro bike, but if you lived in Wales, Nick, we got a 20-mile MPH. Are you okay with that?
Well, there's 20 mile. Wales was among the first to have it such the 20-mile-an-hour areas so widespread. But those areas have spread to the rest of the country. And if you drive through London, there's almost nowhere where it's above that speed. I understand your concern, though, Bo. Thanks for that. Wood Green. Hello, Saul.
Hello. Okay, yeah. So, basically, cars are just getting bigger and wider. Whenever I leave London, I'm always amazed to see all the older cars. Because in London, they've all been phased out. All the cars, you know, sort of 10 years old, you see lots of them. They're all much smaller, much thinner.
Yeah.
And so you've got these cars getting wider, And now you're going to get these roads getting smaller. And, I mean, in London, it's funny, because you go to these old shopping centres that are built like 10 years ago, and if I go with my family, everyone's got to get out the car first before I park.
Yes.
And then I get, and then I park, and then how do I get out the car? Mm. Because I literally, so there's, if you bang your car door against someone and someone sees it, someone will, you know, you'll get insurance claim or someone will go mental, so you can't do that, because all these beautiful new electric cars, you scratch it. See, how do you get out of the car? So there's sometimes it's a farcical where I have to squeeze my body, you know, and I'm putting on a bit of weight to get out the bleeding car. So there's that. And then, but the thing is, I think something's got to give, because I don't believe London is made for these big cars, and somehow someone's got to stop this sort of, because I've noticed that if you have a big car, everyone else has got to have a bigger car.
Yes,
and
it's like a bigger car. It's a size race, isn't it? They're becoming bloated. They're ridiculously big now, and you only notice how big they are when you see an old car that these new big ones were based on, like the old Fiat 500 or the old Mini,
yes,
which are microscopic, like comedy small, like toys they look. And people used to drive around quite happily in them. Now, I know that a lot of the increase in the size of cars is safety-related, and you can't really do very much about that. If you want to survive a crash, then it's going to have to get slightly bigger than it used to be, but not to the size of the... I mean, people are driving around in tanks.
I think the size is also to do with just the sheer amount of battery that's in these cars. I mean, if you want to have a battery that's bigger, that gets you further, because everyone wants to get you further and faster, the battery's just got to get bigger.
Mm, so I'm not sure about that, because there are battery cars that are just a normal size of a saloon, as it used to be 20 years ago. I mean, the saloon, what do you call them? The Elon Musk's car. What do you call those again?
Tesla.
It's a normal-sized car, and that's supposedly at the cutting edge of battery technology, so it can be done. Saul, I'm sorry, I've got to move on. A lot of people want to chip in on this. Bishop Stalford, hello, Jeff.
Yes, a very good morning to you. I've had a look at this size of things. I recently got knocked off my bike in a very narrow road where a car tried to squeeze past because the traffic light's just gone green.
Mm.
And he knocked him off. Luckily, it was into bushes, so I didn't get majorly injured or anything like that. It never stopped because the traffic light went green. So that's the effect of a narrow road. They will slow down a bit, but they're still pushed past.
Yes.
Now, the average width of a car, I've done a little bit of research on this because I thought you might appreciate that. If you take a width of a Ford Puma, with its wing mirrors folded out, it's 1,930 millimetres wide. Okay? The Mini Countryman, if its wing mirrors folded out, is 2,069 millimetres wide. So it's a little bit wider. It's about another 140 millimetres wider. A Mercedes GLE, which is reckoned a huge, whopping, great big car,
yeah,
is 2,141 millimetres wide, which is only just a little bit wider than your Mini Countryman.
Right. Now, that doesn't... because this article was working in feet and inches...
I can do inches, right. So the Mini Countryman is 81.5 inches, and the Mercedes GLE is 84.9 inches.
I wonder if the size of cars is actually an issue, because what can also drive down these narrower lanes are buses, double-decker
exactly.
buses.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Where I live, this narrow country lane has to have double-decker buses, and they can't pass. Single-decker buses. Now, if we come back to the cars, the Mercedes GLE, which is reckoned to be a big, huge, great SUV, is only 3.5 inches wider than the Mini Countryman.
Yeah, there are wider cars and there are taller cars, but I don't think any of the cars that are currently on sale in Britain would have a problem negotiating a road lane that's 10 foot 8 inches wide. The issue is more that they would be, so the plan is, states, they would be reluctant or disinclined to pass cyclists, because if those lanes were so thin, they wouldn't, supposedly the driver wouldn't feel that it was safe to do so. I just wonder whether drivers actually would would think that way. No, your experience, Jeff, is that they wouldn't.
No, I disagree completely. They will try to push past.
Yeah.
Why not make it so you have a cycle lane?
Exactly.
We're aiming for safety. If you narrow the road, you increase the risk of collisions of onward coming cars towards head-on collisions will increase. It's fact. It's proven. Ask the police. Narrow the road, increase the numbers of head-on collisions. Increase the danger to the public. That's ridiculous. Absolutely insane. The guys must have their brains wired incorrectly. They got out on the wrong side of the bed today. Must have done.
Okay, well, that's an interesting thought. Thanks, Jeff. I wonder if it would actually affect people's behaviour, or whether drivers would just try to muscle their way past cyclists, regardless of how wide the lane is. Chiswick, hello, Dawn.
Good evening. Oh, this has really wound me up, this subject. I'm a motorist, and I just want to say that we've got more important problems in this country to consider regarding with or whoever's thinking about this. But let me just tell you a couple of points. The roads are already narrow compared to other countries in the world, and that especially
They're narrow compared to America. I mean, they're not narrow compared to driving around cities in, France.
Not
and
in
Italy, and so
Italy,
on.
I know. Yes, absolutely, America and all that. But also, I would say regarding in London and in other cities, I believe like Oxford, there's already cycleways, okay, that are already taking up half the road, and that. And if anything, and the Welsh listener who was on a couple of minutes ago, I absolutely agree. But whoever you had that other guy who was talking about societal cost and that on the road, due to air pollution and all that. Sorry, that argument does not stand with me. I'll tell you why, because especially on the main high street in Hammersmith, like the King Street, which is half of it is the cycleway and that. I live and work in Hammersmith, and due to Cycleway 9, that the traffic is always at gridlock. I'm a pedestrian most of the time, okay, and every time I'm walking up and down that street and that, the traffic is at gridlock because cars, lorries and that, and buses can't move, especially if there's a bus picking up passengers.
But hasn't that road always been like that?
No, and that before the Cycleway 9 came in, traffic could overtake. If the buses wanted to park, the cars can overtake.
Right, but now they're sitting in traffic. I got it. I've just run out of time in this half hour, Dawn, but there'll be more chance to talk about this later in the hour. I'm going to go for the news. And then we're going to talk about house building. Taylor Wimpey, the major house builder, has urged the government to announce more support for first-time buyers. We're going to talk about that. Come back to more of your calls on this this proposal to narrow our road lanes. But first, at just past 11:30, it's the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Home Secretary says new asylum measures are not racist and will tackle the broken system. Shabana Mahmood's proposals would only allow refugees to stay in the UK temporarily, while also meaning it would take longer to secure settled status. A man's been arrested on the suspicion of murder after a 21-year-old woman was found dead at a boatyard in West Wales. The body of Corinna Baker was found on Saturday lunchtime at Cardigan in Ceredigion. And some of the US National Guard troops who've been sent to Chicago and Portland are being withdrawn by the Pentagon. President Trump claims they were needed to reduce crime and help immigration enforcement. LBC weather, dry and cloudy for many areas overnight, with blustery showers along North Sea coasts. They could be wintry in the far north of the UK and across higher ground. We'll see a low of around 0 degrees.
This is LBC.
Do you know your state pension age? No. Maybe you're not sure. Or you don't know how to check. It's so quick and easy to check online. All you need is your date of birth. Knowing your state pension age helps you think about your future. So check yours today. Search state pension age on gov.uk and simply enter your date of birth. State pension age. It's good to know.
Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crisp in with Walkers. Delicious.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Are you a London black cab driver thinking of ways to boost your earnings during those quieter times? Why not consider Uber? We can give your meter a wake-up call. Join close to 1,000 black cab drivers already on Uber. Black cabs on Uber are priced by your meter, and the service fee will be no more than 5% until the end of 2025. Turn downtime into prime time. Go to uber.com/blackcabs to start earning today. Terms and conditions apply.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
The boss of one of Britain's biggest house builders has urged the government to announce more support for first-time buyers to revive a property market that has, in their words, cooled in the very long shadow of the looming budget. Let's talk about this with Sam Demetriou. Sam is head of policy at the Britain Remade campaign group and joins us on the line now. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
What do you make of the idea of helping people to get onto the property ladder?
I think this would be a mistake to subsidise new people buying homes. I think fundamentally what we have is a problem of insufficient supply. Over generations, going back a very long way, we have built too few homes for the number of people who live in Britain, for the places where people want to work the most. We haven't built those homes. The best way of making housing affordable for first-time buyers is to bring down the cost, the prices of housing, through building more homes.
But would that would the one necessarily follow the other, given that the market is dominated by a handful of massive developers?
Well, we need to reform the planning system so that we can get Britain building again. One of the big problems is it's so, so complicated to get planning permission in the first place that only very, very large companies are able to supply those homes. I went to a development, well, I say a development, it's waiting planning permission, in North London. It had a 1,250-page planning application. It had about 30 to 40, I think, different assessments that had to be filled. And this was for 14 flats. No wonder it's really difficult for businesses to supply those homes for the market when we have such huge barriers to entry for anyone who wants to disrupt the market and open it up to competition. So you're only left with the big house builders who build a certain kind of development, which there's a place for it, but these developments tend to be slower moving and they don't come on the market as quickly, and they tend to be much more vulnerable to shifts in the property market. While when you see things like smaller builders, their incentive is to bring the homes to market as quickly as possible because they don't have that huge working capital. They don't have all those schemes they can spread the risk of delay across.
Those regulations that you mentioned, I mean, that sort of pile of paperwork that was necessary, is that really the government sort of over-regulating the sector, or is it the government's response to developers trying to put substandard product on the market?
Well, I don't think these regulations have much to do with substandard product. I mean, when you look at what these regulations are concerning, they're having to carry out tons of assessments for things that could be very clearly dealt with better planning policy. In a lot of countries, you don't have to fill all of these things out. You don't have to fill out a assessment for, you know, recreational pressures on local parks. You don't have to fill out an assessment for noise or light or et cetera, et cetera. They kind of set these policies kind of straightforwardly. And that actually means it's much easier to get those homes built. Now, there is a problem with new builds not being as good as they could be, I'm sure. But the way to solve that is through competition. It's through removing some of these barriers to competition. And in particularly, you know, that some of these things are responses to real concerns people have. They don't want an ugly building overlooking them. They don't want, you know, a very, very tall building in a very low density neighborhood. They don't want overlooking and that sort of thing. But those can be dealt with really clear, bright line rules. It can be dealt with things like design codes. Those can be very straightforward and don't introduce all of that risk. The problem is there's so much risk in this process that you end up with only the biggest companies can afford to navigate it. And you've seen mass exodus of small builders from the market over decades.
Well, I mean, a reading of what you just said could be that these rules, this sort of labyrinthine process that developers have to go through, are actually designed to take the smaller developer out of the way of the major big builders who probably have an endless supply of lobbying money.
Now, I'm not sure that these big developers are lobbying to make it as complicated as possible to crush the competition. You know, that you know, it's almost as if they were. So it has the same effect, but in practice, I don't think they actually think it's a good idea to have all of these rules. But the problem is, it's where they allocate what they spend their time lobbying on. And I'm sure everyone would love a subsidy for their industry. If, you know, if you can get one, that's great for you because that's cash that would have been going somewhere else going to you. But the problem is at the moment, Britain has a really, really rough fiscal picture. So if we are spending money on an incentive, whether it's something like Help to Buy, whether it's a targeted tax relief for new first-time buyers, that money has to come from somewhere. The government doesn't seem to want to cut spending by that much. So that's probably going to be taxes on other people, or it's going to be borrowing. And the problem with borrowing is that pushes up pressure on things like interest rates, which is what makes it unaffordable for first-time buyers in the first place.
Yes, it's kind of bizarre, really. I know it's a unique product, a home, but it's hard to think of many other things that the government would intervene in the market to try to prop up, essentially, the profitability of the major players in that market.
Yes, and I think part of the issue is, you know, in the short term, demand is an issue and that's affecting it. And if your main focus is hitting that 1.5 million home target and you want to do it through the path of least resistance, I can see the appeal of trying to, you know, smooth over some of those things. But without that fundamental reform to actually make it easier for smaller builders to come in, to compete away and actually start bringing homes to market at a much faster pace, you end up with a situation where, you know, money that could be going to the NHS, it could be going to prevent our income taxes going up, and they'll go up, whether it's with a base rate rise, as they've ruled out, but probably go up via the tax thresholds freezing. You know, all of that money has to come from somewhere. And unless you figure out how to get homes built without giving away all these big subsidies, then that's going to be a serious problem. So that what I would suggest is you look at some of these rules around, you know, brownfield development. You know, the site I looked at, that was building on a building that already existed. It was a commercial space. It was near lots of other blocks of flats. It's exactly the perfect place to build. In fact, if you look at the London plan, the area it's in is designated as an opportunity area. It's the place the government wants us to build. And yet they had to jump through all of those hoops and they might still be rejected. So we need to make those kinds of things as automatic yeses as possible, get those on the market, and then you'll start to see house prices come down, maybe not in real terms, but maybe not in nominal terms, you know, the actual figure, but allowing wages essentially to catch up so it's more affordable for the average buyer, and bringing down rents too, because that's really important. Because one of the big problems for first-time buyers is actually saving that deposit in the first place. And why can't they save for a deposit? Because rents are really high. Now, New Zealand, they moved to a system in Auckland, their biggest city, where you essentially had that automatic planning approval for new homes near busy public transport corridors. And what they saw is that in that city, compared to the other cities who yet to have that reform, rents were 30% lower than they otherwise would be. If you imagine 30% off your rent, the amount of money you could save from that, that would probably get you a deposit much faster than any kind of Help to Buy scheme, which as we know from when it happened, puts pressure on the housing market and actually increases house prices. So it gives with one hand and takes with the other.
Yes, that was the perverse effect, wasn't it, of trying to, well, not to, supposedly trying to help people onto the property ladder. Yeah. It actually put the homes that they were trying to buy even further out of their reach because there was so much money sloshing about.
Exactly, and that's what we need to avoid. We need to understand that Britain has a supply problem. And that supply problem, we've made it very hard to build homes. And that's actually meaning that some people are really struggling to build homes, even when house prices are so high and the demand is so strong. But we should fix those supply problems, not try to paper over the cracks with another demand side subsidy. Because if there's one thing we know doesn't work, it's subsidizing people buying homes, because that just pushes up prices.
Yes, the example that you gave in London is an interesting one, and building on brownfield sites where there where infrastructure already exists, roads and transport links and shops and so on. But that's not where most homes are being built. You take a train trip up and down the country and you'll see loads of brand new developments, and regardless of how far you travel on that train, they're all the blooming same. Hideous, tiny, angry, red little houselets stuck in the middle of nowhere as though they're clenched-fisted shouting in the middle of this blighted field. Why do they all have to be so ugly?
Well, I mean, you know, the phrase is not in my backyard. Well, if you look at these places, they tend not to be in anyone's backyard, right? They tend to be on a road that gets you to a train station or it gets you to an office, but fundamentally they're not near people. That's why they tend to be the easiest place to allocate new housing supply. Most countries actually do a much better job of densifying their urban areas, densifying those suburban areas that could take a little bit more density. You know, in a lot of parts of the world, you'll see suburbs where they're starting to throw up what we might call granny flats. Other countries give them all sorts of different names, where, you know, people are sort of expanding outwards or gentle extensions and things like that. You have one, two stories upwards. But that doesn't really happen in the UK because we've made it really, really complicated, even though we have such a big supply problem. So the places that we think are the best places to build, that, you know, whether you're an environmentalist who wants to make it easier for people to walk or cycle or get the bus to work, whether you're someone who wants to see, you know, homes built in the areas where it's most profitable and most rational to build in terms of getting people to the best jobs and boosting the economy that way, and whether you want to see it protect nature and protect the countryside, we're actually making those sort of developments that do all of those things much, much, much harder because we've layered on rule after rule. We've made it too easy for a single person or a committed local group to basically gum up the system and delay things. And councillors don't really ever have an incentive to say yes. If you say yes to a new development, you don't really see your tax base grow like you do in America, for instance. You just see more demand on public services. You see potentially disruption. And if you're in a marginal ward, you probably see a lot of angry residents who tend to be the ones who vote in council elections. Not that many people do vote in council elections. And you risk losing your seat. So the incentives are completely skewed. We need to fix that.
Yes, forgive me, but I noticed that you didn't address the ugly part. Why do our new homes, our new developments, all have to be so blooming ugly? Not only ugly, but almost devoid of any infrastructure. There's no local transport, there's no local shops, there's no local GP surgeries that have been built. They're just sort of standing alone. It's like they've been marooned, like blown there on the wind. So there's that, which implies that we actually need not fewer regulations, but more to force these companies, they're making enough money, to actually provide the things that the new residents would need. And also, why do they have to be so uniformly hideous?
So the ugliness or the beauty question, depending how you want to frame it, is a really interesting one. And I think there are a few things. So one of the things I support is we should say if you want to build within a city near a station, it should be really, really, really straightforward, a real tick box thing. But local areas should be able to sit down and come up with a design code with pattern books. Genuine, you know, this is the sort of thing that we did when we built some of the most attractive parts of London, parts of the country. You know, they were built to a pattern book, which showed you the type of brick you should use, you know, various features around the window. And that's one thing. But there's also a lot of regulation that actually make it harder to deliver beautiful homes. So I'll give you an example. So you might have noticed this summer, it's got a bit hotter than it used to be. And one of the things the government are interested in is working out how we can cool down our homes when it gets very, very hot. Now, you or I might say, well, why don't we let people install air conditioning? And you can install it behind the property, so it's not an eyesore for the public. But the government wants to cut energy usage. So one of the things they insist on is you reduce what's called solar gain. Solar gain, that's sunlight for you and I, coming in through the window, heating up the home. How do you reduce solar gain? Smaller, titchy windows.
Well, if you want to save money, you can. Or you could triple glaze it and just make less profit.
Well, if you triple glaze it, you still get a lot of the solar gain from the light. But, you know, this is what the regulations insist on. You have to reduce your solar glazing, or you have to pay lots of money to figure out how you can get around the regulatory process to prove that you can cool it down without using air conditioning in a much more roundabout way. And developers don't do that because they do want to make money. And most people don't want to pay more for features they don't need. So you end up with all these houses with tiny windows. But then get this, because we know it's going to be much hotter, they expect people to have their window open a lot more. And if your window's open, well, someone might fall out of that window, apparently. So you can either have a little sort, almost like a Juliet balcony sort of thing, like a little fence on it to people. Developers don't like installing those. People don't really want them. So what developers do is they move the window slightly higher up so people can't fall out of them. But then you look at these houses and they just look a bit wrong, don't they?
The
root of these sorts of regulations. Wow. And if someone went around unpicking all of these, you could have more beautiful homes built for less. And if you tie that to letting people build near train stations, you solve your infrastructure problem too. Because there's lots of infrastructure there. There's shops going out of business because they don't have the demand. Why not build more homes near them?
Very good to talk to you, Sam. Thanks for that. Sam Dimitriou, Head of Policy at the Britain Remade Campaign Group. Now we're going to take a short break, then come back to your thoughts about the possibility of reducing the width of road lanes in order to make it more difficult for cars to pass cyclists. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
If at first you don't succeed,
a migrant who is sent to France under the one in one out scheme has returned to the UK on a small boat.
Try.
It is still at the pilot phase, but that has huge potential.
Try.
This pilot with France is a milestone.
And try again.
What we see at the moment is abuse of the legal system. They're using it against us. That's unacceptable.
The government reached for the Danish model in a major migration shake-up.
Denmark's new migration policies have driven down successful asylum claims to a 40-year low. Can Labour start to make gains with the help of the Danes? I'm LBC's Henry Riley, reporting from Copenhagen.
Join me, Nick Ferrari, tomorrow morning to discover what makes this such a great Dane project.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Our pet's in a pickle. We're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Henry's best ever Black Friday sale is now on, and it doesn't get any better than this. With an extra 10% off absolutely everything. That's on top of up to 50% off hundreds of made-to-measure blinds, curtains and shutters. Plus, control your blinds from anywhere with a half-price smart hub when you buy any electric blind, with measuring and fitting always included. And word to the window wise. Order now for blinds and curtains fitted in time for Christmas. Book your free in-home appointment today at hillarys.co.uk. Conditions apply.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the sports media industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Niamh, a sports media student in Year 12.
During class, I've edited football videos for social, reported on games and even produced my own highlight packages. Working directly with the industry makes me excited for my future career in sports broadcasting.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So road lanes across the country are to become either narrower or wider, depending on availability of space. Lanes which have been 12 foot for 150 years are considered no longer appropriate because of the safety risk posed to cyclists. Instead, they will shrink the lanes to no more than 10 foot 8 inches wide, or if there's space, expand them to 12 foot 10 inches in order to make it safer for cyclists. But of course, in most towns, there isn't the space to make the roads, the road lanes wider, unless you cut into the pavement, and probably don't want to start doing that. So what are your thoughts on the idea of making road lanes narrower in order to stop drivers from overtaking cyclists? Brent, Anas.
Hi, Nick.
Anas.
Hiya. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Great stuff. Thanks for having me. From my perspective, it is this issue of narrowing or widening the roads has two facets. So I have a car and I have a bike and I cycle to work every day. Back in 2008, when I first came to the UK, I was walking in Dorset and roads are basically not as London's roads. So I used to drive because my job requires to drive. I worked for a utility company. Mm-hmm. So it was more making sense to drive, obviously, long distances, a couple of hundreds of miles every day. So it makes sense to drive in those roads. And I left the country back in 2010, worked elsewhere, in Spain, Italy, came back in 2019. Now, when I came to, in 2019, I came to a work in London. And immediately I realized that I need a bike because public transportation is awesome. I mean, compared to other European countries.
Yeah, particularly in London, public transport is very, very good.
Especially in London.
Yeah.
And, I use it literally every day. If I go somewhere, I only drive the car that I have bought back in 2020, beginning of 2020. Or actually late 2019.
Yeah, but what point would you like to make, though, Anas?
I'm just saying that it can be balanced between, like, people can use public transportation while having a car. Because when I cycle to work every day, as I texted you, people are blocking the roads for no reason, in my opinion, because I'm a driver, I'm a cyclist, and I'm a driver as well. I can choose to take my car to Cheswick, where I walk, or I can choose to cycle or use public transportation, which is brilliant.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a London thing. I'm sorry I'm going to have to cut it short there because I'm running out of time in this hour, but that's a London thing, isn't it? For the rest of the country, the public transport is not as all-encompassing as it is in London, and so this might impact those outside London more than in. But I appreciate that, Anas. Brickhouse, hello, Colin.
Hello there, Nick. I didn't know I were listening to This Is Your Life and, our group as a boy and all that sort of stuff and the friends that I met on the way. But anyway, let me get on to what I've got to say. First of all, in West Yorkshire, we've got a lot of cycle lanes here that cyclists won't go in because the roads aren't swept. So they don't want punctures in the tyres.
Swept? Right.
Sweat, you know what sweat means, don't you? Road sweepers.
Yes, right, okay.
And take all the rubbish away. Mm. So they won't go into the cycle then, so they come. There is a law, actually, that says that every motorist, if you look in our way code, you'll find it, every motorist has to give at least a yard to a cyclist when you're overtaking. Mm. Now, this guy who you've had on at the first, right, I don't know what drugs he's on. I'm not on drugs. But I think he must be on drugs because, you know, the comment about, you know, we'll remove the islands in the middle of the road that protect pedestrians. And, you know, I just can't get my head round why we're doing this. How many potholes do we need filling? Is a pothole more danger to a cyclist and a motorist than a blood, than a...
I get it. Yeah, potholes is should be right at the top of the list of things to fix before taking maybe traffic islands out of the way. I can understand why they are a pinch point. They make negotiating around them more difficult with the potential for accidents and so on. But yeah, let's deal with the potholes first. Complete agreement there, Colin. Sorry, mate. I've got to move on. Warrington. Hello, Andrew.
Nick. A49 Warrington Main Arterial Road, there is a large cycle lane being built. And that's fine, I don't mind that. If there was, you know, several tens of cyclists who potentially would use that lane. Now, we all know the pros and cons, but I have to agree with your last caller from Brighouse, who hysterically made me laugh. Because the chap Carlton, who you had on, must have a head like a beach ball, because, you know, there is tax that we pay, and as you just touched on then, potholes are dangerous for every vehicular type of vehicle.
But particularly cyclists, yes. If there's anything that they should concentrate on first, it should be that. Agreed. Sorry, I'm going to have to cut that short, but I've just run out of time in this hour. Coming up after the news, LBC's Nick Ferrari said in an interview with The Telegraph that people are angry at a level I've never seen before. He said that among his listeners, it's immigration and the economy that angers them most. Is this something you have noticed, this increase in anger in society? Or is it just that angry people's voices have become louder? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. Reform UK says the Home Secretary's overhaul of the rules on the country's immigration policy are promising the world. Shabana Mahmood will make an announcement to MPs in the Commons later on today. She's already said her measures are not racist and will tackle the broken system. But the immigration lawyer Philip Trott has been telling LBC only one measure will actually reduce the small boat crossings in the English Channel.
I'd say having a dedicated route via which individuals who genuinely fear persecution can apply. Because at the moment, people are desperate.
The former head of the UK Cybersecurity Agency is calling on social media firms to do more to keep girls and young women safe online. Felicity Oswald is warning levels of misogyny and sexism are rising. She also says many tech firms are cutting budgets for online safety departments. Irish police have described a road collision in County Louth, which killed five people in their early 20s, as shocking and devastating. The car they were all travelling in collided with another vehicle near Dundalk on Saturday night. LBC's Joe Hawkins has more.
Officers in the Irish Republic say the crash involved a VW Golf and a Toyota Land Cruiser, carrying a man and a woman who were taken to hospital. This afternoon, the five dead people were named. Chloe McGee and Shane Duffy were both from Carrickmacross, while Alan McCluskey was from Drumconrath. Dylan Commins came from County Louth and Chloe Hipson was from Lanarkshire in Scotland. It's believed they were on their way to Dundalk for a night out.
The country's main nursing union is warning understaffing in the NHS is leaving its members sick and broken. The RCN says a poll also indicates many nurses feel they're being forced to keep working while they're ill. The Department of Health and Social Care says it's working to improve conditions for the overworked and demoralised workforce it inherited. And researchers are calling for major changes to the education system so artificial intelligence can be integrated into it. A paper from the University of Cambridge says they're needed to meet the major challenges being faced by humanity. LBC weather, dry and cloudy for many areas overnight. Blustery showers along North Sea coast, which could be wintry in the far north of the UK and also over high ground. We'll see a low of around 0 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Nick Ferrari was interviewed by The Telegraph, and he said that among his listeners, it is immigration and the economy which strike at the heart of their anger. On the latter, the economy, he said he's never known his listeners to be so incensed. Let's talk about anger in society with the psychotherapist and broadcaster Lucy Beresford, who joins us on the line now. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Nick.
So what do you think? Is society becoming angrier, or is it the same number of angry people as ever? It's just their voices have become louder.
I don't think it's to say that it's the difference between volume and noise. Actually, I think the last 10 years has seen an amplification in people's growing disconnect with the people that lead them and their own experiences of life. And in a way, we saw that back in 2016, with the Brexit vote, there were a number of people who voted for Brexit because they simply felt that they weren't being listened to, that they weren't heard by the political classes. And that was nearly 10 years ago. And ever since then, I think more and more people have realized that they do have a voice, that actually they can speak out. And of course, social media in particular makes that much more possible. But it does seem that the political elite are not really listening. And there's nothing that frustrates a human being more than anything else than feeling that they are not being heard. It is something that is hardwired into our psyche to be heard. If you've ever heard a baby cry, you will be astonished by how loud it is, given how small the person is that's making the noise. And that is because that is the most basic form of survival. If you lose me, if you drop me, if I fall off your back when you're swinging through the forest, I have to be able to scream loudly. And people don't feel heard, and they feel disappointed and disillusioned by the people who are meant to be listening.
But that surely is not a new phenomenon, is it? I mean, when have politicians ever actually listened to their constituents, other than when they were trying to get their votes in the immediate future? Society hasn't really changed that much, but anger seems to have been ramped up. And I wonder if, I mean, you mentioned social media. I wonder if that is the nexus of it, the amplification of angry voices on social media.
I think it's partly that, and I think it's partly the way in which our relationship to, let's say, voting has changed. So, you know, decades ago, you would have an election every so often. Maybe you'd have some local elections as well, and you would vote or not. But by and large, you would imagine that your vote mattered. Or if you didn't vote, that would probably be because you didn't think that it mattered. And then something came along called reality TV, where we voted for people to stay in houses. We voted for people because we thought they had the better voice, or because we thought they had the better story, the better journey that they were on. And all of a sudden, we got the impression that actually we had more agency in the world. If I vote for this celebrity, miraculously, they end up having to do more chores on a particular TV show, or they get evicted. And suddenly, I think people genuinely thought, oh my goodness, I do get to have a say. And I think that is contributing to the sense of disillusionment around the political structure, because you can only ever have that voice once every so often. It's not every Friday night or every Saturday night as it is with reality TV. You have to wait for the local elections or a by-election or the election. And suddenly people feel less empowered but more vocal. And I think that's what's also contributing to the anger.
So it's Anton Deck's fault?
Pretty much, yes. or Big Brother. So Davina McCall, a national treasure of Davina McCall. But I think it reshaped our attitude to our sense of agency. I can, and actually, funnily enough, I also as you know, I had a show on LBC, and that sense of people being able to phone in and have an actual conversation with either a presenter or sometimes a politician who is brought on as a guest creates this amazing sense of immediacy and an amazing sense of connection. But when those same politicians don't then hit, as you said in your introduction, they don't seem to be paying attention to the cost of living. They don't seem to be paying attention to people's grievances about the NHS. Then that anger is going, that anger is born out of frustration and that sense again of I'm not being heard. They are not listening.
However, it is in the interests of social media and the press to make their users angry and fearful, isn't it? I mean, it is their business model. Anger, therefore, feeds anger, doesn't it?
Well, it's one business model, I have to say, but I don't necessarily think it's the most successful. Funnily enough, most people want a life that works. They want a life that is fair, and they want a life where they can aim for the future and see things come to fruition or manifest, which is the buzzword at the moment. And that's why I often felt that the reality TV shows that played more on conflict and rows and disagreements and people falling out, actually in the end those programs don't last, because human beings, even though we're sort of fascinated by other people having a row or having conflict, that's not what we want. And what we've seen in the last few weeks and months with the infighting within the Labour Party, people in the beginning are intrigued. Oh, who's falling out with who? That's a bit like, you know, who's falling out in the royal family? Who's falling out in my own family? We're curious to that level. But if it goes on too long, people actually start to get very angry because they think you're not meant to be having fighting. You're not meant to be getting angry with each other. You're meant to be looking after us. And that gives another reason for people to feel very dissatisfied and very disillusioned and disappointed by the political class.
Yeah, it's a dichotomy though, isn't it? I agree with everything you just said, but on the other hand, people don't choose their news outlets for reading good news. Good news is no news, not remotely interested. Otherwise, the newspapers would be full of it. The only thing we really want is murder, death, disaster, chaos. That's the thing that really excites us, and that's what news is, by and large.
Well, funnily enough, the clue is in the title, because it's news, and we want the thing that's different. We want the story, the narrative that's different from the day before. But at the same time, what we really do want is a peaceful life, and it's why, as you say, newspapers carry scarier stories. Because you can read them and then you can put them away, safe in the knowledge that that hasn't happened to you. You haven't had that awful thing happen to you. It's why horror movies are so popular. Personally, I don't get horror movies, but from a psychological point of view, people love being scared because they can then leave the cinema no longer scared and safe, knowing that their life isn't like that. So newspapers and media outlets are playing to that same intrigue, which is, yes, give me a little bit of pain so that I can be very relieved that that's actually not my pain. And what's happening with quite a lot of political coverage is it is actually our pain, particularly the cost of living crisis, which appears to have now been going on for sort of 5 or 6 years. This is the pain that a lot of people are living through on a daily basis. And they just want somebody, the people that they vote for, because when we vote, we're kind of infantilizing ourselves. We're saying, okay, I'm not going to fix this problem. I'm going to vote for you so that you can fix this problem. That's why people are increasing. I think Nick Ferrari is absolutely right. People are increasingly frustrated, not least because, one might argue, that the Labour Party campaigned in 2024 on a promise of change. And now people are dissatisfied and disappointed because change doesn't appear to have materialised. In fact, it appears to have been more of the same.
Yes, well, I mean, there's an element of infantilisation with that, isn't it? Because people expected Keir Starmer to be a wizard and he could just wave his magic wand and everything would be immediately okay. But that was never going to happen after 14 years of the Conservative Party smashing up the place. It's going to take a long time, and that that grown-ups don't seem to get that is, it's a bit embarrassing, really. But on that subject, do you think that the politicians, because there are quite a few politicians who are, Labour's enemies on the other side of the House, they seem to be not necessarily tapping into people's anger, but creating it. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, how I would counter that would be to say I don't think the anger would be sustained if it didn't tune into something that was already there. And I think that's why parties on the other side of the House, as you so elegantly put it, are at least riding high in the polls at the moment, because they are able to tap into a vibe, a mood that a lot of people feel anyway. They this sense again of we're not really being listened to. So you can pick up a lot of points in polling simply by giving the impression that you are listening. Whether you can actually deliver on changing or turning things around is a moot point. And one might argue will only be, the proof of that pudding will only be in the eating after the next general election. But if your campaign strategy, as it was last year for Labour, which was to not really say what they would do at all, their main sense was, we're not going to be like the last lot, people will be frustrated simply because that in a way, that's the manifesto promise that's been broken. Nothing to do with tax cuts or rises. It's actually that you said we wouldn't have this chaos, and yet we've still got this chaos. And when you have parties on the other side of the House observing the chaos, the easiest thing to do is to say, yeah, we see the chaos too. We share your vision, and we won't be like that.
But has it ever been thus, though? I mean, you know, the poor have always got poorer. They've certainly not shared in the wealth that they create, and that seems to be getting worse now. And there's certain politicians who see an opportunity to, climb ahead in the polls, and they're doing well because of it. I think that they are actually creating anger in others. Because if you see anger and aggression in other people, or you're told that they have anger and aggression, does it not normalise and legitimise your own expressions of anger?
Well, so anger is one of the most primitive emotions, and it's a really important and essential emotion because it's a great agent for change. So if, you know, historically you were living in a cave and the saber-toothed tiger came and destroyed something or killed one of your tribe, you needed that anger to fire yourself up, to have the adrenaline to go out and kill the saber-toothed tiger. And so anger has a function, it has a purpose. And as I say, when channeled harmoniously, when channeled healthily, it can be the most tremendous agent for change. And I speak as a psychotherapist who has witnessed people transforming their lives, whether that's because they've left an abusive relationship or they've left a toxic career or they've put boundaries in place in other ways. Anger is good, but it is also contagious potentially. And that's because human beings are also very imitative creatures. So if we see someone being angry, our first instinct is, well, what do they have to be angry about? Should I pay attention to this? Should I start being angry as well? Will that help me survive? So there is a danger for sure, and which is what Freud talked about when he talked about the herd instinct, which is this psychological phenomenon, and we see it in protests, marches, we see it in potentially football crowds or, you know, crowds of people, where a small group of people can influence the mood and behavior of a greater group of people, a larger group of people. Psychologically, that's not an unusual phenomenon.
Yes.
It's just being channeled in a very particular way
Right. Currently
in politics around the world.
So it is contagious, but is anger also addictive? I mean, you mentioned adrenaline. And there is a burst of adrenaline that you get when you get angry, or if you, you know, throw yourself out of a plane with a parachute, or you go and see a scary movie, like you said. And all of those things are, people get positive reinforcement, so they like doing them again and again and again. is addictive. Is anger addictive?
Anger itself is not addictive because it is, one might argue, an innate behavioural response in human beings.
Well, is the expression of anger addictive?
Yeah, what might be addictive is the end result. If being angry gets you attention, if being angry actually gets you the thing you've asked for, if being angry has a positive upside for you in your life or your tribe...
Gets you noticed.
Then you will want to... Exactly. It could be about getting you noticed, or it could be about affecting change. Mm. And that's what you might get very addicted to, is the end result. It's like, well, this obviously works. Being really wild obviously, you know, helps me, so I'm going to do it again.
Get you likes on social media. Well, anger channeled badly or kept in has a negative effect. So what practical methods can we do to de-stress and tone down this anger?
Well, my favourite thing to actually suggest to a lot of my clients is physical exercise, because that channels the adrenaline in a very different way, whether that's going for a run, going for a brisk walk, taking up kickboxing, anything that kind of gets you pounding in some way. Even swimming, which a lot of people think is a very gentle activity, it's simply the action of using your body, getting the feel-good endorphins sloshing around your system, and that in itself can really dampen down the anger. Because in a way, it's a bit like when you have a little toddler who's having a tantrum, you know, get them outside, running around, kicking a football or something, and they're, miraculously their tantrum subsides. But you yourself can also help yourself by being, in a way, much more emotionally stable. People talk about the red mist descending. I didn't know it was me. This isn't really me. Well, it is you. So you need to channel a lot of your emotion and stabilize it. You need to learn emotional regulation. And we do that best through really basic things like good sleep hygiene and protocol, good consumption of food, minimal stimulants and minimal alcohol intake, and just doing things that are really good for de-arousing you. So things like mindfulness, physical exercise, meditation, yoga, that kind of stuff.
Very good to talk to you, Lucy. Thanks so much for that. Lucy Beresford, the broadcaster and psychotherapist. So Nick Ferrari says that his listeners have never been so irate, never been so incensed in all of his time working on the radio. Do you think that it is genuine, a feeling of anger at the way that things are, or are people being persuaded to be angry by those who would benefit from that? 0345-6060-973, LBC.
This is LBC.
Welcome on board this LNER service from London King's Cross to Edinburgh. My name's Paul, your train manager today, and hang on, is that a Scrabble tournament in Coach here? Yes, G with an X is a word. Right, we're cruising at 125 miles per hour, same speed this lad next to me is typing. Someone's on a roll! The cafe bar's in Coach G if you fancy a brew, or if you're mid-box set binge, just order through the QR code at your seat. We'll deliver it. So sit back and enjoy your journey. With LNER, it's freedom all the way.
This could be the best Christmas ever. Christmas Cash Call is here with a life-changing £100,000 to be won. Enter this week's draw before 5 p.m. Friday and you could get a call with £100,000. Christmas Cash Call. Text radio to 822 00 to enter now. Text costs £2.50 plus your standard network charge. 18 plus UK only global network competition. Full rules and free entry at ChristmasCashCall.com.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345-6060-973.
If you look at the media, if you look at social media, if you look at the press, then you will probably get the idea that we are becoming angrier. But I wonder if that is actually true, or whether it's just those angry voices are being highlighted by social media and the press for their own financial benefit, and by politicians who would seek to market that anger and thereby improve their prospects of running the country at some point in the future. 0345-6060-973, Bath. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Nick, you okay?
Yes, good, thanks.
So are we getting angrier, or are angry people just getting more of a platform? I think it's probably a mixture of both. You've talked a lot about the latter with your guest. I think we have to look at the fact that even with everything that's happening in the world right now, there will have been similar periods throughout history where in which I'm sure there was a lot of dissatisfaction amongst people. What the game changer is for me is the increase of sedentary lifestyle and the production of ultra-processed foods, which we know from scientific research do have an impact on your mental health that we're still looking into.
Huh, well, that's interesting. A sedentary lifestyle. So that sort of feeds into what Lucy Beresford was saying at the end there about exercise being beneficial to sort of calm down your mood.
Well, yeah, I mean, she was more talking about it in the light of sort of, you know, doing a pounding exercise and doing a calming exercises. But I'm more thinking about just the way in which we're spending our energy. And a good way to think about this is sort of how well you sleep after doing a lot of physical exertion, like going on a long hike, versus how well you sleep after a long day at the office. In both situations, you're incredibly tired, but in one in which you have sort of a physical tiredness, which is kind of more linked to our physiology, I suppose, and another that's more linked to our sort of mental state and related to being sat down all day. Because if you're sat down all day, you're not necessarily spending a lot of energy, and yet we still feel really tired and jaded. And yeah, certainly what we eat and how we behave links massively to our capacity to feel emotion.
Yeah, and I think that what we do while we're sitting down all day, which to a large extent is gawping at our phones and doom scrolling or whatever you want to call it, that is certainly feeding into that anger, because the sites that you're looking at will feed that anger back to you. If you click on something that's, you know, like a fight in the street, then they will keep feeding you that stuff, which will make you feel on edge or irate or whatever it is, and then it sort of feeds itself.
Yeah, and I think there's also so much pressure, and you talked about this briefly, on us to be angry about stuff and to take a staunch position. You're either black or white on certain issues, which I don't feel used to be the case, certainly not before social media.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, giving platforms to people to talk about things that they really don't know anything about, and to have a very, very passionate view either for or against on a certain issue, which can't help anger at all, really.
No. All right. Good talk to you, Laura. Thanks for that. Yeah, we've been persuaded to join a gang, haven't we? You're either in the Jets or the Sharks. And everything that you think of, every issue that comes your way, is coloured by which gang you've decided to be in. East Yorkshire. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Mick.
Mike.
Yeah. Just apologise quickly for last week. I ended up forcing you to defend Donald Trump, and I regretted that afterwards.
Did you? I don't recall that. You'd think I would.
You said I have to put the opposing view on.
Oh, right.
Oops,
right.
I shouldn't have done that.
Okay.
yeah, this thing about anger. What causes people anger instantly is when they have something taken away from them. And all the snake oil salesmen are saying, look at them all, they're coming over here, they're taking your houses, they're taking your doctor's appointments. And that angers people because they think something's being stolen from me. That generates a huge amount of anger. And they're very good at portraying this. The ECHR, they've taken away your right to deport people, that people can stay here because the kid doesn't like certain chicken nuggets. They've taken away your right to get rid of these people. And people think something's being stolen from them.
Mm.
And the same thing applied with Brexit at the end of the day. They're saying, oh, they're taking your sovereignty. And people get angry when they've been constantly pushed at them. Somebody's robbing you of something. They're taking it away. Even down to the pensioners with the fuel allowance.
Mm.
They rang up furious. about the whole thing, because that somebody's nicking something from me, I'm going to get angry, I'm going to fight.
Yes. And
they're very good at doing this.
Right. Social media, most certainly, and politicians, certain politicians, absolutely, yes, they are particularly good at manipulating people's emotions and making them feel as though they are being brought down by those beneath them on the ladder, usually, when actually what's happening is that they're being pushed down by those above them on the ladder. Good to talk to you, Mike. Thanks for that. Manchester. Hello, Christine.
Hello, Dick. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yes, I want to talk about anger. Well, I don't think we're angry, but we are disgusted that the government has, that the media has disrespected the public, and they rip up tension, unnecessary tension. Because journalists are supposed to be intelligent, have a balanced view, and then, you know, share it with the nation. But what they tend to do is they whip up tension where there's no tension to be whipped up, and, all right, somebody's made a mistake. But at least they've come, you say Labour Party made a mistake with the old age pensioners fuel thing. Mm. But they did come back again and corrected, not like the last government who just ignored everything and just let it deteriorate and deteriorate. Our public services are right in the dustbin. And of course, they did say in their manifesto they wouldn't do this, that, and the other, but they didn't realise how bad the state was of the country. They hoped that it wouldn't be that bad. But the Labour government have to dig very deep to come back and get the country back on its feet, you know. And I don't think people are angry with angry for the sake of being angry. No, they're angry with people like Ferrari, who's such a right-wing journalist. He absolutely salivates when there's something, a very little thing about the Labour Party made a mistake, you know. Well, he gets up and down, and he whips up tension, you know. I just switch him off.
I don't see that myself. I think that people who call Nick Ferrari aren't in a state of high agitation, aren't angry with Nick. They're angry about whatever the subject is that Nick is asking them to call in on. So I'm not sure that's quite right, Christine, but thanks for that. Springfield in Oregon. Hello, Andrew.
All right, Nick.
Andrew.
I think there's a lot of anger just being created on one side. I'd say generally on the right, use a bunch of lies. Oh, look, there's some false statistic. Blame it on someone else. And then you have a different type of anger, which is all the people that then hear that lie, and they've just had two callers in this direction, have heard the lies and gone, why do we keep hearing all of these lies? It's insulting. It's just flat-out rude. They're Christians, most people in England and America.
So you're saying that
commandment against lying,
right,
bearing false witness. I mean, it's just absurd to have a society that panders to a group of people that just feed and thrive on lies as if they're honest players.
So people get angry, and then people who aren't angry get angry when they hear those angry people. Therefore, the disease feeds itself. Yes. Interesting. Thanks, Andrew. We're going to take a break for the news, and you can't have failed to notice that it's got considerably colder outside, so we're going to check in with a weather expert to see what we have to come. 0345 6060 973. We're also going to check in with our US correspondent before the hour is out for the latest from there. But first, it's the headline news at just after 12:30 with Tim Daly.
It's expected the Home Secretary is to ban three African countries from accessing UK visas if they fail to take back illegal migrants. The move applying to Angola, Namibia and the Democratic Republic of Congo is part of Shabana Mahmood's plans to reform the country's asylum system. The former head of the UK Cybersecurity Agency is calling on social media firms to do more to keep young women and girls safe online. Felicity Oswald is warning that levels of misogyny and sexism are rising. And the country's main nursing union says understaffing in the NHS is leaving its members sick and broken. The Department of Health and Social Care says it's working to improve conditions for the overworked and demoralised workforce it inherited. LBC weather, dry and cloudy for many areas overnight with blustery showers along North Sea coasts. We'll see a low in some places of around 0 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
A southern train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes with kids' tickets for £2 at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
Cold Arctic air is set to sweep across the UK as communities in Wales are still recovering from severe flooding and inundated properties and disrupted transport and power networks. It's all getting more and more extreme, or so it seems. Let's talk about these issues with John Hammond. John is a meteorologist and chief forecaster for the website Weather Trending. Hello, John.
Good evening, Nick.
So there's been a lot of it. There's been floods in Spain, multiple occasions of floods in Spain, hurricanes in the Caribbean. We've got storms here. We've got floods after a drought that's apparently so bad we'll still be suffering the effects next spring unless we get a lot more rain. Is this just normal fluctuation, or are these events becoming more extreme and more common?
Bit of both, Nick. I hate to sit on the fence, but it's a complicated picture. I think that the common denominator which links a lot of those events which you've just listed there is the fact that around the globe, actually, you know, the sea temperatures are generally higher than they would normally be, let's say 20, 30 years ago. And that is the rocket fuel for a lot of these extreme storm events. It's the moisture, it's the heat which comes out of the sea, which generates the various weather systems which you've seen, be it hurricanes in the Caribbean, be it the incredibly stormy deluges we've seen across parts of the Mediterranean and Spain, and indeed Storm Claudio, which affected parts of England and Wales with the phenomenal amounts of rain, which locally caused those flooding pictures we've seen for the likes of Monmouth. So yeah, the other thing that happens at this time of year, Nick, is that whilst we've got that sort of lingering residue of very warm water around the oceans after a very hot summer across parts of the Northern Hemisphere, what we also now have is cold air trying to break out of the Arctic. And when that cold air meets the warm waters underneath it, that is a recipe for a lot of instability. So there's lots of factors sort of coming into play. Some of it is a sort of feature of climate change, if you like. Some of it is just normal for this time of year when you've got cold air meeting the warm waters. That is rocket fuel for some very stormy weather. So is it climate change? Yes, a little bit. Is it quite normal for this time of year? Yes, it is a little bit as well.
Yes, it's not as commonly discussed, the temperature of the sea, as the temperature on land, is it? And yet the one very much affects the other.
That's right. I mean, the atmosphere, the oceans, they work in unison. You know, the one breeds off the other, if you like. It's one joined up system. You can throw in the ice as well, the cryosphere, as we call it, across Arctic regions. So all these different sort of sources of energy around the globe, they feed into a giant system distributing heat around the globe, either through the atmosphere or through the oceans. So it all works together, and there are lots of knock-on effects. If you get anomalously warm waters, that feeds into the atmosphere. If you have sort of less sea ice than you'd normally have at this time of year, as we have now in the Arctic, that also feeds into atmospheric weather patterns as well. So it's a roller coaster of a ride, particularly at this time of year. It's a transition time of year with that residue of heat in the oceans, and now with the days getting ever shorter, a lot of cold air trying to burst out of the Arctic. And it's going to be a very interesting winter to come, I fancy. Various other factors coming into play too, Nick.
Why has it been so pleasantly warm here lately?
I mean, you know, each month, most months these days are warmer than the long-term average. So, you know, the first half of November across much of England and Wales in particular has been the warmest sort of early part of November on record. Why? Well, part of it is due to the fact that we've got all those warm waters around our coastline. So whichever way the wind blows in, it's blowing in across anomalously warm water. So that's meant that we're more likely to get warmer weather, as we've seen over the last few weeks. I mean, there are other factors at play as well. We've had a lot of high pressure across much of Europe through the summer months. That's meant a lot of sunshine too, and that's heated up the ground, so the ground is warmer than it would normally be at this time of year as well. So these sort of factors come into play, plus the fact that you know, the atmosphere is warmer than it used to be 30 or 40 years ago. There's no two ways about it. So we are now, you know, the default setting for our climate is some degree or two warmer than it used to be. Cold months are now pretty rare and getting rarer. That's not to say we won't get, you know, the odd month that is colder than normal, but by and large, most months now are on the warm side and we're getting used to it. So when we get a cold spell, a cold snap, as we're going to see over the next week or so, it's more of a shock to the system than it would normally be, because we're just so warm, or we're so used to warm weather that, you know, it's a bit of a novelty when we have to get out the winter coats and actually wrap up, as we will do in the week ahead.
Now, you said snap, cold snap. That rather implies a short-lived period. Is that your assessment?
Well, at the moment, yes. I mean, this cold spell coming down from the north through this week ahead is nothing out of the ordinary. I've seen some headlines in, you know, suggesting it's going to be unusual. It isn't. It's fairly run-of-the-mill for the middle of November. You know, frosty weather with some snow around is not that unusual for November. So to put it in context, we're not going to see some deep freeze, which is going to last for week after week after week. Does look as if this spell will probably linger right the way through this week and probably into next weekend before the warmer Atlantic winds come in across those warmer seas. So, yeah, the next 4 or 5, maybe 6 days will be on the cold side. Some of us will have snow, Nick. Most of us won't. A good few of us will have a frost, and it'll be the first frost of the season, which again, in the middle of November, talking about the first frost of the season, cast your mind back 20, 30, 40 years, we'd be getting frosts in, well, late September, October normally. But yeah, for many, we haven't seen a frost yet. So again, that'll be a shock, particularly for gardeners. And in terms of snowfall, I'm not expecting that much in the way of disruptive snow. There will be some snow across, you know, the Highlands of Scotland, the usual suspects, parts of Northern England, particularly over the Pennines. And there'll be some wintry flurries elsewhere, but for many, actually, a pleasant change from all the recent rain. It's going to be a sparkling week ahead, crisp sunshine, but a chilly wind and some fairly sharp frost to come, particularly where you've got snow cover. Whenever you've got snow cover and clear sky, you know, you can easily get a minus 10. So there will be parts of Highland Scotland, for example, later on this week, Nick, that get as low as minus 10, minus 12 degrees, which will make the headlines. But I must reiterate, it's not that unusual. It shouldn't be that unusual at this time of year.
But at the beginning of our conversation, you implied that we were about to go into an unusual period. The word you used was interesting. We're going to have an interesting winter. That sounds ominous.
Well, there are a few other factors at play, Nick, which lead me into that conclusion. And one of them is the fact that in the stratosphere, there is a cycle of winds. Normally, the stratospheric winds high above the Earth, around 30, 40, 50,000 feet up, they normally blow from west to east across the belt across above the tropics. Now we're into an easterly phase, so the stratospheric winds have gone into reverse. That's not unusual. It's part of a regular cycle. But when you tend to get easterly stratospheric winds above the tropics, that lends itself to more blocking. It tends to block our jet stream. And when the jet stream is blocked more than usual, that tends to hinder those milder Atlantic winds, and you're more likely, or the odds are greater, that you'll get winds from the east or from the north, which for us is a colder direction in winter. So that's one of the factors which suggests, and the computer models are bearing this out, that we're going to get a fair bit of blocked weather through December, perhaps into January. that's good if you're a cold weather fan. That raises the stakes, raises the odds of some cold spells into December and perhaps January and some snowfall potentially. But it's not good news for those who need rain. The water companies, the Environment Agency are concerned given how dry it's been through this year so far. We need a wet winter. Now, the computer models so far are suggesting, if anything, more likely to be drier than normal through certainly the first half of this winter. That's a little bit ominous in terms of next year and concerns about drought, but it's also ominous in terms of raising the likelihood of colder outbreaks from the east or the north. So I don't think this winter coming is going to be like last winter. Last winter was predominantly mild, wet and windy. I think that's less likely this winter. I think there's a greater chance of lower temperatures and some snowfall, particularly through the first half of the winter. It's one to watch.
And how far ahead can you see? Because I know we're a little way out, but there is always a yearly frenzy of interest as to what is going to happen on a day in about 5 weeks' time.
To which I always say, I'll tell you on Boxing Day. there are, you know, our skill at long-range forecasting is greater than it used to be. And most of the computer models are certainly suggesting that between now and the middle of December, if not the latter part of December, there's going to be a lot of blocked weather patterns. There'll be a fair bit of high pressure, which means a lot of dry weather. But with winds coming in from the east and from the north, what comes out of the sky is more likely to be snow than it would otherwise be. So I'm sounding a little bit vague and sort of non-committal. But what I'm really saying is that the chances of a white Christmas perhaps are somewhat higher this year than they would normally be. That's not saying much, because most Christmases are green, and on balance, it's still likely to be a green Christmas, but the chances of it being a white Christmas probably are somewhat higher this year than most.
Very good to talk to you, John. Thanks so much for that. John Hammond, meteorologist, chief forecaster for the website Weather Trending. Now we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be crossing to America to talk to a US correspondent. This is LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Clive Ball.
As the rumours of plotting continue, would Labour be crazy to oust Keir Starmer? And what was life really like in 1975?
Clive Ball at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the future you want. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Imad, a GCSE student in Year 11.
Alongside my core GCSEs, such as Maths, English and Science, I study creative subjects such as Media, Drama, Art and Design, Business and Music Technology, which are all recognised by the industry.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Welcome on board this LNER service from London King's Cross to Edinburgh. My name's Paul, your train manager today, and hang on, is that Scrabble tournament in coach here? Yes, G with an X is a word. Right, we're cruising at 125 miles per hour, same speed this lad next to me is typing. Someone's on a roll. The cafe bar's in coach G if you fancy a brew, or if you're mid-box set binge, just order through the QR code at your seat. We'll deliver it. So sit back and enjoy your journey. With LNER, it's freedom all the way.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Right, off to America now. I'm happy to say that David Smith, the Washington Bureau Chief of The Guardian, is on the phone and joins us now. Hello, David.
Hi, great to be here.
Much to talk about. Let's start with Donald Trump versus the BBC, shall we? What do we know?
Well, I think we're still expecting a formal legal filing from Donald Trump on this. And, sometimes he makes threats and doesn't necessarily follow through, and it's hard to take it entirely seriously when Friday he was tossing numbers around. You know, it might be $1 billion. It might be $5 billion. I noticed Tony Hall, former BBC boss, saying, you know, the BBC should not pay anything. So we'll see what the coming week has. We know that there might be a conversation at some point between Donald Trump and Keir Starmer, and one would love to listen to that to see how apologetic Starmer might be, and what he would say about the BBC, and whether he would make a plea for Trump to back away. And we heard the White House say last week that this is one issue where Trump disagrees with the Prime Minister, even though they get on well in other areas. But, you know, more broadly, I think what's going on here is Trump loves to grandstand and make a show of these things, even if he's not always entirely serious. I think most legal experts say he's got very little chance of winning this case. And, you know, we've seen some of the BBC defense around iPlayer is not available in the US. I mean, very few people actually saw this documentary. It clearly didn't hurt Trump in the election, which he won anyway. But, you know, Trump does enjoy the spectacle. He loves bashing the media. And actually, over the past year, that has worked out for him financially as well, because he's had cases against ABC and CBS and even YouTube. And rather than go through a very long and painful and expensive legal battle, those organizations decided to settle out of court to the tune of, you know, like $15, $16 million. So we'll have to see if the BBC comes under pressure to make that kind of concession.
Yeah, the difference between the BBC and ABC, CBS and Meta was that they weren't, engaged in merger talks, which needed the approval of the White House. And in Meta's case, they were keen to get regulatory help. I mean, those companies, they had no intention of fighting it. They were just writing off these seven-figure checks that they signed as the cost of doing business in Trump's America, weren't they?
Indeed. They are very different cases. And this is Trump taking his war on what he calls the fake news media, sort of international, really. I mean, it's extraordinary for him to be targeting a foreign media organization in this way, and it's notable he seems to be getting an assist from GB News, who were all over this at the White House press briefing, and you know, goading the White House press secretary to bash the BBC. You know, on the other hand, I think it should also be noted that those cases we're talking about in America, take the CBS one, which related to an episode of 60 Minutes, an interview with Kamala Harris, their own defense team and pretty much every expert who watched it said, you know, CBS did nothing wrong here in their editing of that interview. And yet, for the reasons you say about mergers, they coughed up money anyway. I think their offense was significantly less than the BBC's, which, you know, everyone, including the corporation itself, acknowledges this was a bad edit, and you know, was misleading in the way it portrayed Trump. So there's, you know, there's different circumstances and different degrees of offense here. But all of that said, I think still, you know, Trump's case here is very weak, and you know, he's enjoying the prospect of, you know, sending a chill to the media as he does on these occasions, hoping that it encourages, you know, some editors in some places to self-censor. I think worth noting, on the other hand, he sued the New York Times and the Washington and the Wall Street Journal, and they have firmly stood their ground, and they've said, you know, don't give in to the bully, because, you know, the bully will keep coming back for more.
Yes, the Washington Post caved. That was Jeff Bezos' newspaper, as did many universities. So, and I think they have subsequently found that caving into a bully doesn't actually do you any good in the long term. It might relieve pressure in the short term, but the demands will just keep on coming. So the BBC should absolutely stand their ground. I mean, apart from anything else, the statute of limitations rules out suing in the UK. And if he takes the case to Florida, am I right in thinking that there's a higher bar for defamation in Florida that's going to work against Trump? I mean, he basically has no chance of winning this, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very long shot legally for him. But that hasn't stopped him in the past.
No. To put it into context, he's been involved since 1973 with about 4,000 court cases. If he had a court loyalty card, he'd have enough points for a return trip to Mars.
The sad comment on the legal system, I suppose, is that, as we've seen recently, for some organisations, it still just feels the path of least resistance to sort of throw some money at him and say, please go away. We don't want to be entangled in years of litigation over this. And therefore, he still has made some money for his presidential library. So I think, it's interesting. There are people in America and all over the world begging the BBC, do not get in here.
Yeah.
Do not send a signal about weakness for others.
Yeah, and don't believe the word of plastic patriots in this country who wrap themselves in the flag while trying to undermine our institutions. So, Marjorie Taylor Greene, let's talk about her. She's got quite the history. She said that removing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would be quicker with a bullet to the head. She harangued one of the child survivors of a school shooting that killed 17, saying that it was staged to pass gun control laws. She said that the California wildfires were started by a Jewish space laser, all of which appeared to be okay for Donald Trump. But then she said that she supports releasing the Epstein files in full, which is apparently a red line for Trump's support.
Indeed, yes. And now she is an unlikely heroine of the resistance, the anti-Trump forces. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia is clearly a very colourful character, and she did say all those things you mentioned and was one of Donald Trump's staunchest allies, and she was heckling Joe Biden at the State of the Union address, I think, just last year. But all that has changed in recent months, and it's partly, as you say, because she's demanding the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files, which Donald Trump does not want to happen. She's among a handful of Republicans who've been very vocal on that. And there are other issues as well. She's criticized her own party over healthcare, and she's had a dig at Trump over being too obsessed with international affairs at the expense of putting America first and the concerns of domestic issues in the U.S. And various other matters. She's become a bit of a loose cannon in the Republican Party. She claims she's the true standard bearer of Make America Great Again, and that Donald Trump has slightly lost his way on that. And all these things in combination with probably the Epstein files being the tipping point. Donald Trump lashed out over the last couple of days and branded her Marjorie Traitor Green and some other nicknames, said he was withdrawing his support from her, would no longer endorse her for elections, he would back a challenger to her next time she runs in the midterms. She is still being outspoken, having a go back at him, but at the same time saying she hopes they can make up one day. She also claims that his hostility now has led to death threats against her. So it's all a bit of a mess, and it points to that rare thing, a Republican actually standing up and defying Donald Trump. And in that sense, it kind of echoes our first subject of the BBC. And, when do you give in to him and when do you oppose him?
Yes. To what extent is this MAGA movement actually fracturing? Because it seems to be being pulled apart by people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. There's Nick Fuentes, people who say that Donald Trump isn't, to be simplistic, right-wing enough, that he is not actually putting America first, which was the policy that he ran on. And there seems to be a dissent in the ranks.
Yes, and there was some commentary today about how, 6 months ago, it was an extremely united movement. And, of course, it swept Donald Trump to election victory, but of course we've seen that so often, haven't we? When you're in opposition, you do unite very easily, and then once you're in power, the fractures start to show, and everyone's fighting. certainly, you know, there are some dissenting voices, and there are sort of internal battles. The likes of Tucker Carlson are up against Ben Shapiro over issues such as Israel, and Carlson criticizes Trump for being too pro-Israel. There's Marjorie Taylor Greene over the Epstein files. There's a few other voices saying Trump is giving in to the tech entrepreneurs, those oligarchs who were at his inauguration, the Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk figures, and he's therefore forgetting the workers, and having styled himself as a working class champion, he's leaving those people behind. And there's a debate there over visas, for example. Steve Bannon is always interesting to watch on these, influential podcaster and former Trump advisor. He was quoted today as saying, you know, Trump knows his movement's base better than anyone, but a lot of his base feel he's spending too much time on Palestine and not enough on East Palestine, Ohio.
And yes, he's also trying to persuade the American public that what they see in front of their eyes is not true. And by that, I mean prices in the grocery store and the tariffs that he has leveled. He keeps to telling people that it's not actually essentially a sales tax, but that's what it is. And he's rescinded some of the tariffs in order to try to quell that that anger, hasn't he?
That's right, yeah. Part of this fracturing of MAGA and part of the reason Trump's approval rating is at an all-time low, and also Republicans did badly in elections last week, is the affordability crisis in America. You know, Trump can spin a lot of lines on many issues, but it's hard to convince people that they're not spending more for groceries and other things when they sort of going hungry. He's really criticized by some for losing touch with his base and working class people generally. This exact same time, he's building a $300 million ballroom at the White House. He's throwing Great Gatsby-themed parties at Mar-a-Lago. It's pretty terrible optics. We're seeing that in the polling. Some people suggesting already he could become a lame duck president if he doesn't wake up to this this cost of living crisis in America.
Well, wake up is an interesting way of putting it, because he does seem to be falling asleep a lot lately.
Yes, exactly. A few articles of that. He was seen in the Oval Office seemingly dozing off. And again, you know, when Joe Biden did that, or seemed to be doing that, all hell broke loose, of course. And yet Trump often seems to be treated to a different standard. But certainly some critics have noted it. He's 79 years old. Some of his statements are so jumbled and rambling. You might question his mental coherence.
Yes.
On the other hand, I would say often he does maintain a pretty hectic schedule, sort of traveling around the world. I mean, he had a big Asia trip, and then he was back the same day doing Halloween with the kids at the White House.
And to be fair, he does present himself to the press probably more than any president in history.
That's right. I mean, I myself am sometimes in those gatherings, last weekend was following on Air Force One. And as journalists, we love that access. I mean, it's questionable just how useful it is sometimes when it's either lies or repetition or nonsense. But
it's ratings.
Ratings.
David, excellent work. Thanks very much for that. That's David Smith, the Washington Bureau Chief at The Guardian, joining us there from America. Well, that's it for this show. Thanks very much for your calls and your tweets and for listening. If you missed any of it, then you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news in the categories in the order that you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts, in amongst which you'll find mine. If you don't have it, the new LBC app is free. You can get it from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, coming up at 4 on LBC. It's Henry Riley. And first, in for Ian Payne, Richard Spur.
Good morning. Still to come, working in an understaffed NHS is leaving nurses sick and broken, according to the Royal College of Nursing. I'll be asking how you feel the NHS can improve the number and quality of the doctors and nurses who work for it. But first, plans to fast-track the deportations of illegal immigrants as part of a sweeping reform of the UK's asylum policy are to be announced by the Home Secretary. She's to outline plans to end multiple appeals against removal and for an overhaul of legislation on human rights law. For those granted asylum, they'll only be given it on a temporary basis and will be returned home if their country is at any time deemed safe. They're going to have to wait 20 years to apply to settle permanently. But should the UK